Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Well, I want to come out here, first of all, to tell you that Jay is prepared for all your questions and is very much looking forward to the session. Second thing is I want to let you know that over the next couple of weeks, there are going to obviously be a whole range of issues, immigration, economics, et cetera. We'll try to arrange a fuller press conference to address your questions. The reason I actually wanted to come out today is not to take questions, but to speak to an issue that obviously has gotten a lot of attention over the course of the last week, the issue of the Trayvon Martin ruling. I gave a preliminary statement right after the ruling on Sunday, but watching the debate over the course of the last week, I thought it might be useful for me to expand on my thoughts a little bit. First of all, I want to make sure that, once again, I send my thoughts and prayers, as well as Michelle's, to the family of Trayvon Martin, and to remark on the incredible grace and dignity with which they've dealt with the entire situation. I can only imagine what they're going through, and it's remarkable how they've handled it. The second thing I want to say is to reiterate what I said on Sunday, which is there are going to be a lot of arguments about the legal issues in the case. I'll let all the legal analysts and talking heads address those issues. The judge conducted the trial in a professional manner. The prosecution and the defense made their arguments. The juries were properly instructed that in a case such as this, reasonable doubt was relevant, and they rendered a verdict. And once the jury's spoken, that's how our system works. But I did want to just talk a little bit about context and how people have responded to it and how people are feeling. When Trayvon Martin was first shot, I said that this could have been my son. Another way of saying that is Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago. And when you think about why, in the African-American community at least, there's a lot of pain around what happened here, I think it's important to recognize that the African-American community is looking at this issue through a set of experiences and a history that that doesn't go away. There are very few African-American men in this country who haven't had the experience of being followed when they were shopping in a department store. That includes me. There are very, very few African-American men who haven't had the experience of walking across the street and hearing the locks click on the doors of cars. That happens to me, at least before I was a senator. There are very few African Americans who haven't had the experience of getting on an elevator and a woman clutching her purse nervously and holding her breath until she had a chance to get off. That happens often. And I don't want to exaggerate this, but those sets of experiences inform how the African-American community interprets what happened one night in Florida. And it's inescapable for people to bring those experiences to bear. The African-American community is also knowledgeable that there is a history of racial disparities in the application of our criminal laws. Everything from the death penalty to enforcement of our drug laws. And that ends up having an impact in terms of how people interpret the case. Now, this isn't to say that the African-American community is naive about the fact that African-American young men are disproportionately involved in the criminal justice system, that they're disproportionately both victims and perpetrators of violence. It's not to make excuses for that fact, although black folks do interpret the reasons for that in a historical context. They understand that some of the violence that takes place in poor black neighborhoods around the country is born out of a very violent past in this country, and that the poverty and dysfunction that we see in those communities can be traced to a very difficult history. And so the fact that sometimes that's unacknowledged adds to the frustration. And the fact that a lot of African-American boys are painted with a broad brush and the excuse is given, well, there are these statistics out there that show that African-American boys are more violent. Using that as an excuse to then see sons treated differently causes pain. I think the African-American community is also not naive in understanding that statistically, somebody like Trayvon Martin was probably statistically more likely to be shot by a peer than he was by somebody else. So folks understand the challenges that exist for African-American boys. But they get frustrated, I think, if they feel that there's no context for it, and that context is being denied. And that all contributes, I think, to a sense that if a white male teen was involved in the same kind of scenario, that from top to bottom, both the outcome and the aftermath might have been different. Now, the question for me at least, and I think for a lot of folks, is where do we take this? How do we learn some lessons from this and move in a positive direction? You know, I think it's understandable that there have been demonstrations and vigils and protests, and some of that stuff is just going to have to work its way through as long as it remains nonviolent. If I see any violence, then I will remind folks that that dishonors what happened to Trayvon Martin and his family. But beyond protests or vigils, the question is, are there some concrete things that we might be able to do? I know that Eric Holder is reviewing what happened down there, but I think it's important for people to have some clear expectations here. Traditionally, these are issues of state and local government. The criminal code and law enforcement is traditionally done at the state and local levels, not at the federal levels. That doesn't mean, though, that as a nation, we can't do some things that I think would be productive. So let me just give a couple of specifics that I'm still bouncing around with my staff. You know, so we're not rolling out some five-point plan, but some areas where I think all of us could potentially focus. Number one, precisely because law enforcement is often determined at the state and local level, I think it would be productive for the Justice Department, governors, mayors, to work with law enforcement about training at the state and local levels in order to reduce the kind of mistrust in the system that sometimes currently exists. You know, when I was in Illinois, I passed racial profiling legislation And it actually did just two simple things. One, it collected data on traffic stops and the race of the person who was stopped. But the other thing was it resourced us training police departments across the state on how to think about potential racial bias and ways to further professionalize what they were doing. And initially, the police departments across the state were resistant, but actually they came to recognize that if it was done in a fair, straightforward way, that it would allow them to do their jobs better, and communities would have more confidence in them, and in turn be more helpful in applying the law. And obviously law enforcement's got a very tough job. So that's one area where I think there are a lot of resources and best practices that could be brought to bear if state and local governments are receptive. And I think a lot of them would be. And let's figure out, are there ways for us to push out that kind of training? Along the same lines, I think it'd be useful for us to examine some state and local laws to see if it if they are designed in such a way that they may encourage the kinds of altercations and confrontations and tragedies that we saw in the Florida case, rather than diffuse potential altercations. I know that there's been commentary about the fact that the Stand Your Ground laws in Florida were not used as a defense in the case. On the other hand, if we're sending a message as a society in our communities that someone who is armed potentially has the right to use those firearms, even if there's a way for them to exit from a situation, is that really going to be contributing to the kind of peace and security and order that we'd like to see? And for those who resist that idea that we should think about something like these Stand Your Ground laws, I just ask people to consider, if Trayvon Martin was of age and armed, could he have stood his ground on that sidewalk? And do we actually think that he would have been justified in shooting Mr. Zimmerman, who had followed him in a car, because he felt threatened? And if the answer to that question is at least ambiguous, then it seems to me that we might want to examine those kinds of laws. Number three, and this is a long-term project, we need to spend some time in thinking about how do we bolster and reinforce our African-American boys. And this is something that Michelle and I talk a lot about. There are a lot of kids out there who need help, who are getting a lot of negative reinforcement. And is there more that we can do to give them a sense that their country cares about them and values them and is willing to invest in them? I'm not naive about the prospects of some grand new federal program. I'm not sure that that's what we're talking about here, but I do recognize that as president I've got some convening power, and that there are a lot of good programs that are being done across the country on this front. And for us to be able to gather together business leaders and local elected officials and clergy and celebrities and athletes and figure out how are we doing a better job helping young African-American men feel that they're a full part of this society, and that they've got pathways and avenues to succeed. Yeah, I think that would be a pretty good outcome from what was obviously a tragic situation. And we're going to spend some time working on that and thinking about that. And then finally, I think it's going to be important for all of us to do some soul searching. Yeah, there have been talk about should we convene a conversation on race. I haven't seen that be particularly productive when politicians try to organize conversations. They end up being stilted and politicized, and folks are locked into the positions they already have. On the other hand, in families and churches and workplaces, there's the possibility that people are a little bit more honest, and at least you ask yourself your own questions about, am I wringing as much bias out of myself as I can? Am I judging people as much as I can based on not the color of their skin, but the content of their character? That would, I think, be an appropriate exercise in the wake of this tragedy. And let me just leave you with a final thought, that as difficult and challenging as this whole episode has been for a lot of people, I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country. And so, you know, we have to be vigilant, and we have to work on these issues, and those of us in authority should be doing everything we can to encourage the better angels of our nature, as opposed to using these episodes to heighten divisions. But we should also have confidence that kids these days, I think, have more sense than we did back then, and certainly more than our parents did or our grandparents did, and that along this long, difficult journey, we're becoming a more perfect union. Not a perfect union, but a more perfect union. All right? Thank you, guys.
Context of White Supremacy, Justice, Gus T. Renegade, in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, July 19th, 2013. So I have been told. We will be back tomorrow. Compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. There were so many news reports related to racism, white supremacy. We could do two compensatory call-ins this week, and I could have 2 hours for both programs filled with news clips. In fact, one of them could be a full 2 hours of Trayvon Martin, and the other one could be all the other stuff that happened related to racism, white supremacy. It has been quite a week. But tune in tomorrow. Looking forward to hearing from non-white people, victims of racism or white supremacy, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. As I said at the beginning, we were late today because I was speaking with Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. She should be here on Sunday evening, to be specific, to catch up on what has been going down, her views on racism, white supremacy. She emphasized again, you've had a lot of people talking about racism. What do they mean when they say racism? You don't have a definition. You don't have an understanding of what that means globally. You are just talking in the wind. Lots of talking in the wind this past week, too. We also have a program on Monday, but we should be going strong. Someone messaged me and they said, could we have a program in response to Trayvon Martin, or just having a program to kind of pick up people's spirits after the verdict? And it's like, wow, we've been on every day since the verdict. We were on when the verdict was read live. We were on the air. I think the only days that we were off is Monday and Tuesday. Other than that, we've been on every day since the verdict. And white people permitting, we will be on every day until at least Monday. So I hope this has been some form of compensatory aid for folks who are not in mental health, which would be all non-white people victims of racism, white supremacy. Moving forward, today's broadcast, the final study session on Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. I hope the study sessions have yielded constructive suggestions. The anti-blackness has been on the move this week, in my opinion, and this year in total. Hopefully some of these suggestions can help mitigate that. If lots of people have been talking about racism, white supremacy over the past few days, generally, it's been my experience that a lot of those dialogues become heated exchanges. I have frequently heard people say, don't talk about politics. Don't talk about religion. I've never heard anyone say, don't talk about racism. That can get real explosive. And I have not found anything more explosive than racism, which is going to take in all areas of people, activity, religion, politics, and everything else, including sex. So I suspect if more people are talking about racism with other folks as a result of the trauma that folks are experiencing or rage connected to the Zimmerman acquittal, maybe some of the suggestions, tips in this book will help to keep those conversations constructive, courteous, with as little tension as possible. We will get started. Most of what you're going to hear in the final session this week is reinforcing what has already been said about refraining from criticizing. And if you do have to point out an error or something that is incorrect, the best way to go about doing it. That's definitely one I think we should all have our ears perked and be paying attention for. I think we, many of us as victims of racism, can be very quick to judge, critique, fault find, kind of look down our nose at victims of racism that we think are more confused or doing things that are not going to end the system of white supremacy. Really want to be careful about that. I don't think anybody likes to feel like they're stupid. I don't think anybody likes to feel as though they are defective. I think a lot of non-white people feel that way anyway. I think I read Amir's Questlove, his post, where he was talking about how he had heard all his life that he wasn't shit. I think that's most non-white people's experience worldwide. So just being mindful of that when we go to talk to other victims of racism. I think one of the big tips from this week, too, is going to be if you do have to point out an error in trying to correct it, if you're on the job or another situation dealing with someone in your family where you do want to point out an error that they made or where they maybe mistreated you or someone else. One of the big tips, make sure you reference your own errors, too. It's been my experience that frequently when we become less confused about racism, white supremacy, some of us slip into that pattern, and I do it myself sometimes, of behaving as though we've always been a little bit more codified. We've always been a little bit less confused, and that is definitely not the case. I think people are much more receptive when you can talk to them in a manner to saying, hey, you're not in this alone. I've made tons of errors. I'm still confused. I'm still learning. This is nothing unique to you. White people have done a job on all of us, and we're all trying to figure things out, do the best we can to improve. It's been my experience. People are much more receptive to that as opposed to, you dumb, ignorant Uncle Tom, what are you doing? You're messing it up and ruining everything for Black people. Very low success rate with that approach. Maybe I just haven't done it right. We will get started with the first audio segment. I'll give out the number so folks can dial in once it concludes. Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People, Context of White Supremacy. President Obama was working the word context quite a bit today.
One of the major areas of controversy between members of the Army Reserves and their regular Army trainers is haircuts. The reservists consider themselves civilians, which they are most of the time, and resent having to cut their hair short. Master Sergeant Harley Kaiser of the 542nd USAR School addressed himself to this problem when he was working with a group of reserved non-commissioned officers. As an old-time regular Army Master Sergeant, he might have been expected to yell at his troops and threaten them. Instead, he chose to make his point indirectly. "Gentlemen," he started, "you are leaders. You will be most effective when you lead by example. You must be the example for your men to follow. You know what the Army regulations say about haircuts. I'm going to get my hair cut today, although it's still much shorter than some of yours. You look at yourselves in the mirror. If you feel you need a haircut to be a good example, we'll arrange a time for you to visit the post barber shop. And the result was predictable. Several of the candidates did look in the mirror and went to the barber shop that afternoon and received regulation haircuts. Sergeant Kaiser commented the next morning that he already could see the development of leadership qualities in some of the members of the squad. On March 8, 1887, the eloquent Henry Ward Beecher died. The following Sunday, Lyman Abbott was invited to speak in the pulpit left silent by Beecher's passing. Eager to do his best, he wrote, rewrote, and polished his sermon with the meticulous care of a Flaubert. Then he read it to his wife. It was poor, as most written speeches are. She might have said, if she had less judgment, "Lyman, that's terrible, that will never do. You'll put people to sleep. It reads like an encyclopedia. You ought to know better than that, after all the years you've been preaching. For heaven's sake, why don't you talk like a human being? Why don't you act natural? You'll disgrace yourself if you ever read that stuff." That's what she might have said. And if she had, you know what would have happened. And she knew, too. So she merely remarked that it would make an excellent article for the North American Review. In other words, she praised it and at the same time subtly suggested that it wouldn't do as a speech. Lyman Abbott saw the point, tore up his carefully prepared manuscript, and preached without even using notes. An effective way to correct others' mistakes is Principle 2. Call attention to people's mistakes indirectly. Chapter 3. Talk about your own mistakes first. My niece, Josephine Carnegie, had come to New York to be my secretary. She was 19, had graduated from high school 3 years previously, and her business experience was a trifle more than zero. She became one of the most proficient secretaries west of Suez, but in the beginning she was, well, susceptible to improvement. One day I started to criticize her. I said to myself, "Just a minute, Dale Carnegie, just a minute. You are twice as old as Josephine. You have had 10,000 times as much business experience. How can you possibly expect her to have your viewpoint, your judgment, your initiative, mediocre though they may be? And just a minute, Dale, what were you doing at 19? Remember the asinine mistakes and blunders you made? Remember the time you did this and that?" After thinking the matter over, honestly and impartially, I concluded that Josephine's batting average at 19 was better than mine had been, and that, I'm sorry to confess, isn't paying Josephine much of a compliment. So after that, when I wanted to call Josephine's attention to a mistake, I used to begin by saying, "You've made a mistake, Josephine, but the Lord knows it's no worse than many I have made. You were not born with judgment, that comes only with experience, and you are better than I was at your age. I've been guilty of so many stupid, silly things myself. I have very little inclination to criticize you or anyone. But don't you think it would have been wise if you had done so-and-so?" It isn't nearly so difficult to listen to a recital of your faults if the person criticizing begins by humbly admitting that he, too, is far from impeccable. E.G. Dillastone, an engineer in Brandon, Manitoba, Canada, was having problems with his new secretary. Letters he dictated were coming to his desk for signature with two or three spelling mistakes per page. Mr. Dillastone reported how he handled this. "Like many engineers, I've not been noted for my excellent English or spelling. For years I've kept a little black thumb index book for words I had trouble spelling. When it became apparent that merely pointing out the errors was not going to cause my secretary to do more proofreading and dictionary work, I resolved to take another approach. When the next letter came to my attention that had errors in it, I sat down with the typist and I said, 'Somehow this word doesn't look right. It's one of the words I've always had trouble with. That's the reason I started this little spelling book of mine.' I opened the book to the appropriate page. 'Yes, here it is. I'm very conscious of my spelling now, because people do judge us by our letters, and misspelling makes us look less professional.' I don't know whether she copied my system or not, but since that conversation, her frequency of spelling errors has been significantly reduced." The polished Prince Bernhard von Bülow learned the sharp necessity of doing this back in 1909. Von Bülow was then the Imperial Chancellor of Germany, and on the throne sat Wilhelm II. Wilhelm the Haughty, Wilhelm the Arrogant, Wilhelm the Last of the German Kaisers, building an army and navy that he boasted could whip their weight in wildcats. Then an astonishing thing happened. The Kaiser said things, incredible things, things that rocked the continent and started a series of explosions heard around the world. To make matters infinitely worse, the Kaiser made silly, egotistical, absurd announcements in public. He made them while he was a guest in England, and he gave his royal permission to have them printed in the Daily Telegraph. For example, he declared that he was the only German who felt friendly toward the English, that he was constructing a navy against the menace of Japan, that he and he alone had saved England from being humbled in the dust by Russia and France, that it had been his campaign plan that enabled England's Lord Roberts to defeat the Boers in South Africa, and so on. No other such amazing words had ever fallen from the lips of a European king in peacetime within 100 years. The entire continent buzzed with the fury of a hornet's nest. England was incensed. German statesmen were aghast. And in the midst of all this consternation, the Kaiser became panicky and suggested to Prince von Bülow, the Imperial Chancellor, that he take the blame. Yes, he wanted von Bülow to announce that it was all his responsibility, that he had advised his monarch to say these incredible things. "But, Your Majesty," von Bülow protested, "it seems to me utterly impossible that anybody, either in Germany or England, could suppose me capable of having advised Your Majesty to say such things." The moment those words were out of von Bülow's mouth, he realized he had made a grave mistake. The Kaiser blew up. "You consider me a donkey," he shouted, "capable of blunders you yourself could never have committed." Von Bülow knew that he ought to have praised before he condemned, but since that was too late, he did the next best thing. He praised after he had criticized, and it worked a miracle. "I am far from suggesting that," he answered respectfully. "Your Majesty surpasses me in many respects, not only, of course, in naval and military knowledge, but above all in natural science. I have often listened in admiration when Your Majesty explained the barometer, or wireless telegraphy, or the Rontgen rays. I am shamefully ignorant of all branches of natural science, have no notion of chemistry, of physics, and am quite incapable of explaining the simplest of natural phenomena. But," von Bülow continued, "in compensation, I possess some historical knowledge and perhaps certain qualities useful in politics, especially diplomacy." The Kaiser beamed. Von Bülow had praised him. Von Bülow had exalted him and humbled himself. The Kaiser could forgive anything after that. "Haven't I always told you," he exclaimed with enthusiasm, "that we complete one another famously? We should stick together, and we will." He shook hands with von Bülow, not once, but several times. And later in the day, he waxed so enthusiastic that he exclaimed with doubled fists, "If anyone says anything to me against Prince von Bülow, I shall punch him in the nose." Von Bülow saved himself in time, but, canny diplomat that he was, he nevertheless had made one error. He should have begun by talking about his own shortcomings and Wilhelm's superiority, not by intimating that the Kaiser was a half-wit in need of a guardian. If a few sentences, humbling oneself and praising the other party, can turn a haughty, insulted Kaiser into a staunch friend, imagine what humility and praise can do for you and me in our daily contacts. Rightfully used, they will work veritable miracles in human relations. Admitting one's own mistakes, even when one hasn't corrected them, can help convince somebody to change his behavior. This was illustrated more recently by Clarence Zerhuizen of Timonia, Maryland, when he discovered his 15-year-old son was experimenting with cigarettes. "Naturally, I didn't want David to smoke," Mr. Zerhuizen told us, "but his mother and I smoked cigarettes. We were giving him a bad example all the time. I explained to Dave how I started smoking at about his age and how the nicotine had gotten the best of me, and now it was nearly impossible for me to stop. I reminded him how irritating my cough was and how he had been after me to give up cigarettes not many years before. I didn't exhort him to stop or make threats or warn him about their dangers. All I did was point out how I was hooked on cigarettes and what it had meant to me. He thought about it for a while and decided he wouldn't smoke until he had graduated from high school. As the years went by, David never did start smoking and has no intention of ever doing so. As a result of that conversation, I made the decision to stop smoking cigarettes myself, and with the support of my family, I have succeeded. A good leader follows this principle. Principle 3. Talk about your own mistakes before criticizing the other person. Chapter 4. No one likes to take orders. I once had the pleasure of dining with Miss Ida Tarbell, the Dean of American Biographers. When I told her I was writing this book, we began discussing this all-important subject of getting along with people, and she told me that while she was writing her biography of Owen D. Young, she interviewed a man who had sat for 3 years in the same office with Mr. Young. This man declared that during all that time he had never heard Owen D. Young give a direct order to anyone. He always gave suggestions, not orders. Owen D. Young never said, for example, "Do this or do that," or "Don't do this, don't do that." He would say, "You might consider this," or "Do you think that would work?" Frequently, he would say, after he had dictated a letter, "What do you think of this?" In looking over a letter of one of his assistants, he would say, "Maybe if we were to phrase it this way, it would be better." He always gave people the opportunity to do things themselves. He never told his assistants to do things. He let them do them, let them learn from their mistakes. A technique like that makes it easy for a person to correct errors. A technique like that saves a person's pride and gives him or her a feeling of importance. It encourages cooperation instead of rebellion. Resentment caused by a brash order may last a long time, even if the order was given to correct an obviously bad situation. Dan Santarelli, a teacher at a vocational school in Wyoming, Pennsylvania, told one of our classes how one of his students had blocked the entranceway to one of the school's shops by illegally parking his car in it. One of the other instructors stormed into the classroom and asked in an arrogant tone, "Whose car is blocking the driveway?" When the student who owned the car responded, the instructor screamed, "Move that car and move it right now, or I'll wrap a chain around it and drag it out of there." Now, that student was wrong. The car should not have been parked there. But from that day on, not only did that student resent the instructor's action, but all the students in the class did everything they could to give the instructor a hard time and make his job unpleasant. How could he have handled it differently if he had asked in a friendly way, "Whose car's in the driveway?" and then suggested that if it were moved, other cars could get in and out? The student would have gladly moved it, and neither he nor his classmates would have been upset and resentful. Asking questions not only makes an order more palatable, it often stimulates the creativity of the persons who you ask. People are more likely to accept an order if they have had a part in the decision that caused the order to be issued. When Ian MacDonald of Johannesburg, South Africa, the general manager of a small manufacturing plant specializing in precision machine parts, had the opportunity to accept a very large order, he was convinced that he would not meet the promised delivery date. The work already scheduled in the shop and the short completion time needed for this order made it seem impossible for him to accept the order. Instead of pushing his people to accelerate their work and rush the order through, he called everybody together, explained the situation to them, and told them how much it would mean to the company and to them if they could make it possible to produce the order on time. Then he started asking questions. "Is there anything we can do to handle this order? Can anyone think of different ways to process it through the shop that will make it possible to take the order? Is there any way to adjust our hours or personnel assignments that would help?" The employees came up with many ideas and insisted that he take the order. They approached it with a "we can do it" attitude, and the order was accepted, produced, and delivered on time. An effective leader will use Principle 4. Ask questions instead of giving direct orders. Chapter 5. Let the other person save face. Years ago, the General Electric Company was faced with the delicate task of removing Charles Steinmetz from the head of a department. Steinmetz, a genius of the first magnitude when it came to electricity, was a failure as the head of the calculating department. Yet the company didn't dare offend the man. He was indispensable and highly sensitive. So they gave him a new title. They made him Consulting Engineer of the General Electric Company, a new title for work he was already doing, and let someone else head up the department. Steinmetz was happy. So were the officers of GE. They had gently maneuvered their most temperamental star, and they had done it without a storm, by letting him save face. Letting one save face, how important, how vitally important that is. And how few of us ever stop to think of it. We ride roughshod over the feelings of others, getting our own way, finding fault, issuing threats, criticizing a child or an employee in front of others without even considering the hurt to the other person's pride. Whereas a few minutes' thought, a considerate word or two, a genuine understanding of the other person's attitude would go so far toward alleviating the sting. Let's remember that the next time we're faced with the distasteful necessity of discharging or reprimanding an employee. Firing employees is not much fun. Getting fired is even less fun. I'm quoting now from a letter written me by Marshall A. Granger, a certified public accountant. Our business is mostly seasonal. Therefore, we have to let a lot of people go after the income tax rush is over. It's a byword in our profession that no one enjoys wielding the axe. Consequently, the custom has developed of getting it over as soon as possible, and usually in the following way. Sit down, Mr. Smith. The season's over. We don't seem to see any more assignments for you. Of course, you understand you were only employed for the busy season anyhow, etc., etc. The effect on these people is one of disappointment and a feeling of being let down. Most of them are in the accounting field for life, and they retain no particular love for the firm that drops them so casually. I recently decided to let our seasonal personnel go with a little more tact and consideration, so I call each one in only after carefully thinking over his or her work during the winter. And I've said something like this: Mr. Smith, you've done a fine job, if he has. At that time, we sent you to Newark. You had a tough assignment. You were on the spot, but you came through with flying colors, and we want you to know the firm is proud of you. You've got the stuff. You're going a long way, wherever you're working. This firm believes in you and is rooting for you, and we don't want you to forget it. Effect? The people go away feeling a lot better about being fired. They don't feel let down. They know if we had work for them, we'd keep them on. And when we need them again, they come to us with a keen personal affection. At one session of our course, two class members discussed the negative effects of fault-finding versus the positive effects of letting the other person save face. Fred Clark of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, told of an incident that occurred in his company. At one of our production meetings, a vice president was asking very pointed questions of one of our production supervisors regarding a production process. His tone of voice was aggressive and aimed at pointing out faulty performance on the part of the supervisor. Not wanting to be embarrassed in front of his peers, the supervisor was evasive in his responses. This caused the vice president to lose his temper, berate the supervisor, and accuse him of lying. Any working relationship that might have existed prior to this encounter was destroyed in a few brief moments. This supervisor, who was basically a good worker, was useless to our company from that time on. A few months later, he left our firm and went to work for a competitor, where I understand he's doing a fine job. Another class member, Anna Mazzone, related how a similar incident had occurred at her job, but what a difference in approach and results. Ms. Mazzone, a marketing specialist for a food packer, was given her first major assignment, the test marketing of a new product. She told the class, "When the results of the test came in, I was devastated. I'd made a serious error in my planning, and the entire test had to be done all over again. To make this worse, I had no time to discuss it with my boss before the meeting in which I was to make my report on the project. When I was called on to give the report, I was shaking with fright. I had all I could do to keep from breaking down, but I resolved I would not cry and have all those men make remarks about women not being able to handle a management job because they're too emotional. I made my report briefly and stated that due to an error, I would repeat the study before the next meeting. I sat down, expecting my boss to blow up. Instead, he thanked me for my work and remarked that it was not unusual for a person to make an error on a new project, and that he had confidence that the repeat survey would be accurate and meaningful to the company. He assured me, in front of all my colleagues, that he had faith in me and knew I had done my best, and that my lack of experience, not my lack of ability, was the reason for the failure. I left that meeting with my head up in the air and with the determination that I would never let that boss of mine down again. Even if we are right and the other person is definitely wrong, we only destroy ego by causing someone to lose face. The legendary French aviation pioneer and author Antoine de Saint-Exupéry wrote, "I have no right to say or do anything that diminishes a man in his own eyes. What matters is not what I think of him, but what he thinks of himself. Hurting a man in his dignity is a crime." A real leader will always follow Principle 5. Let the other person save face. Chapter 6. How to Spur People On to Success. Pete Barlow was an old friend of mine. He had a dog and pony act and spent his life traveling with circuses and vaudeville shows. I loved to watch Pete train new dogs for his act. I noticed that the moment a dog showed the slightest improvement, Pete patted and praised him and gave him meat and made a great to-do about it. That's nothing new. Animal trainers have been using that same technique for centuries. Why, I wonder, don't we use the same common sense when trying to change people that we use when trying to change dogs? Why don't we use meat instead of a whip? Why don't we use praise instead of condemnation? Let us praise even the slightest improvement. That inspires the other person to keep on improving. In his book, "I Ain't Much, Baby, But I'm All I Got," the psychologist Jess Lair comments, "Praise is like sunlight to the warm human spirit. We cannot flower and grow without it, and yet while most of us are only too ready to apply to others the cold wind of criticism, we are somehow reluctant to give our fellow the warm sunshine of praise." I can look back at my own life and see where a few words of praise have sharply changed my entire future. Can't you say the same thing about your life? History is replete with striking illustrations of the sheer witchery of praise. For example, many years ago, a boy of 10 was working in a factory in Naples. He longed to be a singer, but his first teacher discouraged him. "You can't sing," he said. "You haven't any voice at all. It sounds like the wind in the shutters." But his mother, a poor peasant woman, put her arms about him and praised him and told him she knew he could sing. She could already see an improvement, and she went barefoot in order to save money to pay for his music lessons. That peasant mother's praise and encouragement changed that boy's life. His name was Enrico Caruso, and he became the greatest and most famous opera singer of his age. In the early 19th century, a young man in London aspired to be a writer, but everything seemed to be against him. He had never been able to attend school more than 4 years. His father had been flung in jail because he couldn't pay his debts, and this young man often knew the pangs of hunger. Finally, he got a job pasting labels on bottles of blacking in a rat-infested warehouse, and he slept at night in a dismal attic room with two other boys, gutter snipes from the slums of London. He had so little confidence in his ability to write that he sneaked out and mailed his first manuscript in the dead of night so nobody would laugh at him. Story after story was refused. Finally, the great day came when one was accepted. True, he wasn't paid a shilling for it, but one editor had praised him. One editor had given him recognition. He was so thrilled that he wandered aimlessly around the streets with tears rolling down his cheeks. The praise, the recognition that he'd received through getting one story in print, changed his whole life. For if it hadn't been for that encouragement, he might have spent his entire life working in rat-infested factories. You may have heard of that boy. His name was Charles Dickens. Another boy in London made his living as a clerk in a dry goods store. He had to get up at 5 o'clock, sweep out the store, and slave for 14 hours a day. It was sheer drudgery, and he despised it. After 2 years, he could stand it no longer. So he got up one morning, and without waiting for breakfast, tramped 15 miles to talk to his mother, who was working as a housekeeper. He was frantic. He pleaded with her. He wept. He swore he would kill himself if he had to remain in the shop any longer. Then he wrote a long, pathetic letter to his old schoolmaster, declaring that he was heartbroken, that he no longer wanted to live. His old schoolmaster gave him a little praise and assured him that he really was very intelligent and fitted for finer things, and offered him a job as a teacher. That praise changed the future of that boy and made a lasting impression on the history of English literature. For that boy went on to write innumerable best-selling books and made over $1 million with his pen. You've probably heard of him. His name? H.G. Wells. Use of praise instead of criticism is the basic concept of B.F. Skinner's teachings. This great contemporary psychologist has shown by experiment with animals and with humans that when criticism is minimized and praise emphasized, the good things people do will be reinforced and the poorer things will atrophy for lack of attention. John Ringlespaw of Rocky Mount, North Carolina, used this in dealing with his children. It seemed that, as in so many families, mother and dad's chief form of communication with the children was yelling at them. And as in so many cases, the children became a little worse rather than better after every session, and so did the parents. There seemed to be no end in sight for this problem. Mr. Ringlespaw determined to use some of the principles he was learning in our course to solve this situation. He reported, "We decided to try to praise instead of harping on their faults. It wasn't easy when all we could see were the negative things they were doing. It was really tough to find things to praise. We managed to find something, and within the first day or two, some of the really upsetting things they were doing quit happening. Then some of their other faults began to disappear. They began capitalizing on the praise we were giving them. They even began going out of their way to do things right. Neither of us could believe it. Of course, it didn't last forever, but the norm reached after things leveled off was so much better. It was no longer necessary to react the way we used to. The children were doing far more right things than wrong ones." All of this was the result of praising the slightest improvement in the children rather than condemning everything they did wrong. This works on the job, too. Keith Roper of Woodland Hills, California, applied this principle to a situation in his company. Some material came to him in his print shop, which was of exceptionally high quality. The printer who had done this job was a new employee who had been having difficulty adjusting to the job. His supervisor was upset about what he considered a negative attitude and was seriously thinking of terminating his services. When Mr. Roper was informed of this situation, he personally went over to the print shop and had a talk with the young man. He told him how pleased he was with the work he just received, and pointed out it was the best work he had seen produced in that shop for some time. He pointed out exactly why it was superior and how important the young man's contribution was to the company. Do you think this affected that young printer's attitude toward the company? Within days, there was a complete turnabout. He told several of his co-workers about the conversation and how someone in the company really appreciated good work. And from that day on, he was a loyal and dedicated worker. What Mr. Roper did was not just flatter the young printer and say, "You're good." He specifically pointed out how his work was superior. Because he had singled out a specific accomplishment, rather than just making general flattering remarks, his praise became much more meaningful to the person to whom it was given. Everybody likes to be praised, but when praise is specific, it comes across as sincere, not something the other person may be saying just to make one feel good.
Context of white supremacy. The number to dial is 760-569-7676. And the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. The number again is 760-569-7676. And the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you do not want to dial in on your phone, you can use the address tiny.cc/1race. So that's tiny, tiny.cc/1race. When you use that address, there should be a button on the left side of the page, blue button, flash phone. Click it. It will open up a little window. The number I just gave, 760-569-7676. You don't even have to type it. A drop-down window, you'll see the number, select it, and then on the second line, it'll ask for the code, of course, 564-943. Put that in. You can leave the third line blank, or you can put in a handle if you want. Just press the green button at the bottom that says call. It'll connect you to the program. If you would like to speak, just press star 6. You'll see the dial pad. Press star 6, and then it'll give you an audio prompt to select one, and we can get you on the line if you would like to participate. Should work, I think, anywhere on the planet. Quickly, this is not in the book, so I should not be stealing anyone's thunder. They have things they want to touch on from the book. But I was reminded of Dr. Kamal Kamban, kamalkamban.org, one of our favorite guests, kamalkamban.org. I was speaking to him, and he was saying that we were talking about this very topic about giving compliments, praise to Black people, and he had a very wry response. He said, most of the time I don't compliment Black people. And I said, why is that? And he said, most of the time they're not doing anything worthy of compliment. Which is, I mean, that's so Dr. Kamban, just, you know, boom, 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 soldier, just, hey, this is what it is. But I was thinking about that while I was listening to this segment, and I might have to go grab the book from my library, but I was reminded of the book Flames After Midnight, which is about an incident of white terrorism in Texas, where some white people went on a rampage and shot and killed a lot of Black people. This went on for days in Texas. And it finally stopped when a group of Black people, a family, they organ really out of self-defense. It wasn't like they were going out trying to start up anything, but white people were coming to harm them. What gang of white people, terrorists, were coming to shoot up their house, and they had already killed a lot of Black people. And so these Black people, they organized to defend themselves, and you had different Black males. They were out. I mean, it's incredible. It's something that you couldn't even believe. You couldn't even make stuff up like this. But the Black people, they were like hiding in trees and scamped out. They had their rifles and stayed up all night to defend themselves and their property and their land. They even shot some of these white people and scared them off. And that ended this whole reign of terror, white terrorism in Texas. And it reminded me just the little things. I mean, I think at least I was talking about it last week. Everything that Black people, victims of white supremacy, have to endure. I wouldn't care who you are. If you know, whatever your position is, whoever you are, wherever you are, no matter how much money you have or whatever else, just what you have to endure on a daily basis as a victim of white supremacy is astronomical. Just that alone might be worthy of a compliment or something. Just wow. Just everything that you have to tolerate and deal with every day as a victim of racism. Even if that's not worth a compliment at minimum, I am not going to be so hasty to come out of my mouth with a critique. And now I am commenting on the book, so I'll hush and get the folks that dialed in. Let's see, person, Mr. Demery, your line should be open. Mr. Demery, I'll hit the other hands as I see them.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, early in the book, it was said that when writing a letter, while you're angry or disturbed, put the letter in a drawer and lock the drawer. And after about 2 days, when you take it out, you will not send it. So I was thinking that at the same time, we probably should not immediately answer a person in a conversation right away if the subject is that of a severe matter of disagreement, and maybe that by taking some time before answering and thinking about the answer that you're going to give may be constructive. And the book mentioned that Dr. Gerald Nuremberg, getting through to people, cooperativeness in conversation is achieved when you show that you consider the other person's ideas and feelings as important as your own. And I think that when we're talking to other people, like the one caller said that he was, to just be honest, you know, when he's talking to some people, he can't wait until they finish so he can go on and get his ideas out because he's not even interested in what the other person is saying. So I think to make, you know, a lot of these principles work, it's going to take a lot of concentrated effort. And then again, the people in which you're practicing these principles have to be somewhat worthy of your time and patience, because I noticed in some of the anecdotes, you know, some of these people were either valued employees or relatives, and which gave them added incentives to, you know, cooperate with the people and try different things, trying to encourage them, you know, to do better. But to change the subject a little bit, later on, the book talked about fear. And everybody has fear, but a lot of people don't want to admit that they have any types of fears. There's different types of fears. And the book was saying that the brave put down their fears and go forward. You ultimately must face your inner fears. And I think that fear, the word fear, according to the word guide, is a lack of knowledge or information about something. And you're trying to compensate for a lack of knowledge or understanding of something. You know, that made me think about trauma and bad experiences can trigger a fear response that sometimes can be hard to quell and that may become repressed. And so I thought about that in respect of counter-racism. And I think if we're honest, I know I can just speak for myself. When I go back, way back, when I first entered into an integrated situation where I was around a lot of white people, there was some fear. But then as I, you know, encountered them every day and became familiar with their activities, you know, some of the fear subsided. But I think that a healthy fear of white people may be constructive, because fear helps us in a way. It helps us realize dangerous situations and makes us more aware of situations that may present themselves as a dangerous situation. So, but when those fears, when you realize that those fears exist, ultimately, you have to confront them and make an attempt to overcome them. Some people look at fear as a sign of weakness, or some repressed feelings that may have become fear because of a bad experience as a weakness, and won't seek help for that. But I think that that macho type attitude probably would attribute to some types of serious condition and maybe even suicide. I'll mute my line.
Agreed. Demery Fuller, agreed. I think Mr. Fuller, in the word guide, he has the term intelligent fear, where I don't have it in front of me right now, but he is basically saying that for victims of racism, white supremacy, it is correct to regard racist man, racist woman, racist child, master terrorists, that it is correct and logical to have some fear of them, and that you acknowledge that fear in order to plan, get the necessary information to overcome that fear and do what it is that needs to be done, or said, or whatever, however you need to respond. But he calls it intelligent fear, just knowing that, hey, these folks are dangerous and that I should deal with them in a cautious manner, which I think makes perfect sense. I think we do a lot of that, being reckless, dealing with white people, and ends up being a lot of trouble for us. I do also want to make sure this is on the record, while you were giving your response. And this is the second time that I have heard this in this year. This is the second time this calendar year 2013 that I've heard this. I don't know if people are familiar with the television program Dukes of Hazzard. This used to come on some years ago, I think it used to come on in the 70s. It was on a long time ago. I think they did 7-8 seasons, and they had, it's set in the South, Mississippi, I think. These white guys just ride around, racist suspects just ride around and just act crazy all day long, fast car riding, what have you, and messing with the police and what have you. Anyway, they have the Confederate flag on their car that they ride around in, and the car horn is the song Dixie. I don't know if people have seen the show or are familiar with it, but I watched it last year, and I was just like, oh, there's the Dixie thing. I watched several of the episodes full of racism. Anyway, there is a car, at least one in the state of Washington, that also has Dixie on their car horn. And I heard it earlier this year, and just while you were giving your response, I just heard it again. I don't know if they are in the neighborhood or what have you, but I just heard the Dixie car horn. Dedication to racism, white supremacy. And that's Dixie playing here in Washington State, not Georgia or Alabama, Louisiana, Florida, Washington State. We're right next to the Canadian border. Anywho, the comments that he makes, and like I said, this is throughout the book, about refraining from criticizing. That's like the first thing that he says. That's like the first thing that he has on important fundamental techniques that one should take from this book, not criticizing other non-white people. And just in the past 7 days since the Zimmerman verdict, I feel like it's just been a wealth of criticism directed at many black people, non-white people, for a variety of reasons, how they have responded or how they have not responded or what they said or what. It's just tons of that. I mean, that's the easiest thing in the world, and it's the thing that white people enjoy and promote the most. We definitely want to have black people talking bad about blaming other black people and ready to fuss at them for any reason, no reason at all. That's really something you have to be on your guard at all times, even when you're less confused about racism, white supremacy. It is astounding the frequency with which that takes place. I think one of the callers on the compensatory call in and this past weekend, they were saying that so many times, you know, in conversations on racism, white supremacy, it will start out, we're talking about white supremacy, we're talking about white terrorists. And then within 5 minutes, sometimes within 30 seconds, it's, and that black person over there didn't do da-da-da, and that's what's wrong now. And black people do, and I mean, it's just like, wait a minute, I thought we were talking about the racism, what they do, and now it's just, you know, I don't like this victim, I don't like that victim, I don't like how this victim is responding. So, I mean, that is just, it's a standard aspect of racism, white supremacy, and it's something I don't think that we really think about how, when you go out and you criticize other victims of racism, when you engage in that, I don't think we keep in mind like that sort of thing, the lasting ramifications where people end up being upset about that for years, people being upset about that and the whole relationship ends just in that the criticism goes up and that's just it. These people don't even communicate anymore. I remember, I think it was the very first time Mr. Fuller was on the Cows. He said, frequently, black people seek out other black people. Victims of racism, white supremacy look for victims just for the sake of having a disagreement. He said, that's really what we're after. We are not after constructive information. We are not after a courteous exchange, even if it's we just have a difference of opinion and let's, you know, chat it out so I can get a better understanding of where you're coming from, where I'm coming from. I understand we don't agree. That's not it at all. Most, not all, but a large number of us. And this is all a part of how we've been groomed by racist man, racist woman, racist child. We are looking for that non-white person for the sake of having a gripe, an argument, to get that person told. And that's something I think we should really be mindful of. Like I was even thinking there are individuals who will message me, email, whatever the case may be. I don't know who these people are. I've never met them like in person, face to face. We don't have dialogue. We don't have conversations, nothing. I will only hear when they have a complaint about something that happened on the program or something they don't agree with. And I feel like that goes against everything that Mr. Carnegie has been saying. I think you can think for yourself, those folks out there, because I don't think that this is anything unique to me. I think this is just a part of the package of racism, white supremacy, where as a non-white person, people really only seek you out sometimes, it seems, to tell you what you have done wrong, to tell you what is good. Questlove with the Roots again. You ain't shit. He said he heard that. That's what this system is designed to be about. Everybody just go in and you see a black person, find 10 things that this person is doing wrong and get them told right quick. Really making an effort to minimize that behavior. If you can get to having something constructive, if you can point out, you know, something the person is doing that's constructive and really highlight that and have something great to say about that. But at minimum, really make an effort. I'm going to abstain from criticizing, name calling, talking bad, fault finding about this non-white person. They might be doing something I don't agree with, whatever it is. I'm sure they have heard an ample amount of criticism in their life, even in the past hour. I'm not going to add to that. Victim of racism, white supremacy. I'm not condoning, but I am not going to join in line to get this victim told. I really think that's something that we can all work on implementing more. And I think I'm convinced we would see huge benefits. Huge, huge, huge. Try to think of a white person that you can complain about if you feel yourself falling into that pattern of getting on another non-white person. I'll mute my line. If anybody has any other thoughts that they would like to share on the book session, please feel free. This is our last one, so if you have any comments you want to get in on this book period, this last session to do so, we will be moving on new book next week. Do you have anything else, Mr. Demery?
Yes, I remember that you talked about the reaction you got to your shirt. please respect me as if I was a white person. Well, I wore my shirt to a birthday party. It was older individuals that were, we'll say, middle class people, the youngest in their 50s on up. And I just thought it'd be, like you say, a hoop, you know, just to see what the reaction would be, you know. And when I walked in, you know, immediately a woman in her late 40s, maybe early 50s, approached me, and she started to talk about racism. But she was actually getting on black people, like you were saying. She was using that opportunity to, you know, just put down black people and tell me that she hasn't experienced racism from white people, only black people. And so she went on, and I sat there and listened. And I could only think about, you know, not, you know, showing any anti-blackness and trying to relate to her in a positive manner. I ended up asking her a couple of questions. You know, like if she felt black people could be racist, and what was her take on the Trayvon Martin case, Zimmerman's murder case, you know, that type of thing. But she kept trying to pick something with me, but it didn't work because I was just bent on not going to this anti-blackness thing. And then I invited her to listen to the program. And, you know, I showed her the logo, and, you know, I guess it turned out to be pretty positive. After that, about five different people came up to me that wanted a shirt. So that reminded me, you know, that are those shirts still available?
I just found out that we are close to selling out of these shirts. I was mildly surprised because, number one, these shirts are in a totally different state than where I am. And I was not under the impression that this was a hot seller, that people wanted to be out wearing these. But then I checked in because we got double the amount of shirts that we were originally supposed to have. So I was thinking, oh, you know, we'll just have them. People want them or what have you. But we are actually getting close to selling out of the ones that we have. There have been other people who have asked for shirts. So if you let me know, I guess, how many shirts you potentially might need and the sizes, I can let you know if we have those in stock. If not, there had been talk about doing another order. So, yeah, if you let me know, I can let you know if we can take care of it with the shirts that are remaining. And if not, we can make an order. But I do know that we are out of smalls and mediums. I think the sizes, we have large and double X. I think those are the sizes that we have left. But if you let me know if those sizes are working, how many you need, we might be able to take care of it out of what the shirts that we have remaining.
Okay. I'll shoot you an email on that.
Okay.
All right.
But I appreciate the C. I told folks what happened with the shirts. Let's hear what happened with the T-shirt experiment. I thought some interesting things would go down. I'm thankful it's been about a year and a half, and I have not heard any bad stories. No one anywhere in the world, people not just in the States and non-black, non-white people, have the shirt. And I have not heard where anyone was mistreated. I have not heard any reports where anyone was harmed as a result of wearing the shirt. Generally, what I've heard is it has been constructive. Either white people wanted to talk, and it seemed that the white person was trying really hard to not be racist, and or the non-white people were open, and they want, even if they didn't like the shirt or what have you. I did see some ugly commentary on Facebook, but in terms of in-person interactions, I have not heard anything bad. It has been constructive, and or people just looked and that's crazy, that's strange, what is that nigga wearing, that type of thing. But I haven't really heard anybody got harmed or something bad happened to them. But the point that should not be lost in all of that, that the anti-blackness and how it goes to criticizing other black people, resist the urge. You really got to have that in mind, that that's just how we've been programmed to blame and criticize other black people, and to not put that focus on the problem, white people. Really make sure you're on the ball about that, and really try not to get into it. I've even found sometimes that when other people are being anti-black, if you try to step in to be like, hey, this is really anti-black, that can just contribute to it, because then you're criticizing another black person. I've seen where that can happen too sometimes. I think I've even fallen into that sometimes. So you really really got to be mindful about that, and just making sure this person is a victim of racism, and I really want to be on my P's and Q's about not getting into something where I'm just squabbling, arguing, fault-finding with other victims. The person that dialed in, 1804, your line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Can I be heard?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Oh, sorry. I caught the, I've been listening, but I kind of zoned out about the t-shirts. Can you say where people can find them? Can you say the website again where people can order t-shirts? And do you have lady tees?
They are, I feel like I had no idea. Somebody had told me that it would be a year and a half and the t-shirt thing would still be going on. That would just be a wow. I thought this was going to be I thought this would be a one and done thing last spring. The shirts, you can see them. They're on my blog. I'll put the post up so people can see what they look like. We even have a sizing chart, Trav Lyrics, 41510.com, Dr. Trav Lyrics. He has a sizing chart that I can mail so you can look at it to see if they, or what size I guess would fit best, if you're a female, or what size you're on, all that, so you can kind of match the sizes appropriately, so that it'll fit you best. I can send the sizing chart if you want to check that out. The only sizes that we have still in stock are large and double X. We are out of all the other sizes that we had. If those sizes will not work, if you let us know, we can just do another ordering and get more of the sizes in that we had. And I do know that there are other people who wanted other sizing, so they would probably be happy, because we kind of wanted to do all that at once if there's going to have to be another order. So if those sizes won't work, just let us know, and then we can do an order and get smalls, mediums, blah, blah, blah. We even had bigger sizes. We had bigger than double X as well. The shirts, the price, they are $20. That includes shipping. They're mailed out from California. Normally, the shirts have arrived, I think, within 2 to 3 days. Once they actually get mailed, so I can give you an ETA once everything gets moved around. But that's the gist. I'll post a link on my Facebook page that has a photograph of the shirts. Again, they're $20. We only have large and extra large remaining, and I can get you the sizing chart so you can verify what size you'll need.
So it sounds like you just have one standard model of t-shirt, because the lady tee is kind of designed more for women with it's like more form-fitting, and it's got like a V-neck kind of neck. It's kind of more of a women's t-shirt. It sounds like you only have the regular t-shirt.
Correct.
So if I had any sizing request, it would be to add a lady tee, but, you know, just in my own personal, ideal world. But anyway, I'll look at what you have on your site, and I'll let you get on with the show.
Right on. That could be added. That could be added. There were other, quite a few other females who have the shirt as well, already have it, and wanted a different size. So, yeah, that could be added as well. Let's see. Anybody have anything else on the book? Anything else on the book? Folks wanted to get in last session, How to Win Friends and Influence People.
I wanted to mention one other thing. When it says, when you're pointing out someone's mistake, then you talk about your mistakes first. You know, the only thing I can think about is I had an incident you know, if I got a problem, you know, and I go to one of my supervisors or second level, and they start to talk to me about their problems, you know, that kind of tees me off. It rubs me the wrong way because I'm not really in there to hear about his problem. I want him to address my particular problem. And maybe I got the wrong impression of that, but I think he was trying to practice, you know, that particular principle, but it didn't work. It kind of backfired on him because, you know, when someone does me like that, I turn it back around to what I'm concerned with. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong in doing that, but if I'm talking about something and they go to their problem, it makes me feel like they're not addressing what I just said. What do you think about that?
I would say, number one, I would tend to agree. If I came in with an issue or concern, problem, whatever, and somehow it veered to where we're not talking about my issue, we're talking about that person's problem or whatever, that, in my view, that is not correct. I was the one who presented the concern. That's what we should be focused on. However, I'm not sure that that was what Mr. Carnegie intended. I think he was talking about, unless I misunderstood, I think what he was saying was, if you are going to critique someone or point out an error that someone has made, that you can make a reference to your own error first, just so that you're coming in a spirit more of humility. I'm not trying to talk down to you. We all make errors. I make errors. We can, you know, work to correct this. Not that big a deal type thing. I think that's a little different than you coming with an issue where you want feedback or help to solve a problem, and a person veers off from that to start talking about their own problems or what have you. Like that, that to me seems like a totally different situation and incorrect to do.
Oh yeah, that sort of clears it up. I mean, yeah, I believe you were right. That's basically what he was talking about. And I can see that. Because during the times when I used to attend church, it used to rub me the wrong way to hear the preachers talking about the rest of the congregation. And then they're standing in a spot to where it's like they're holier than thou. But the ones that started out and would say, like Malcolm X said on that little clip that you played on the other program, you know, he said, I used to be like that. You know, when a person can see you had, you know, some fallacies, before they can identify with it a little bit more than just you telling them, you know, what you think they should do. So I can understand it.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking of that too. I think many of the folks who I think are effective talking about racism, white supremacy, they do that. I think Mr. Fuller does that as well when he talks about racism, white supremacy. In fact, I have heard him when folks have tried to say, oh, my gosh, Mr. Fuller is this and Mr. Fuller is the doctor or whatever. He has said he has told this to me. He says, when I say victims of racism, white supremacy are retarded, I mean Neely Fuller Jr. first and foremost. And that's huge. I mean, people don't really want to hear that anyway, but it's much easier to take when the person is saying, and they're saying, hey, I'm included in this too. This is not something that's just you. I mean, white people have done a job on all of us. I am retarded. I'm at the bottom of the boat too, trying to work my way out of it. And I think he does that. Still learning. In fact, you could sum all of that up in those two words, still learning. And he says, that's exactly why I answer the phone like that every time. People ask me how I'm doing. Still learning. I'm not an expert on racism. I'm still a victim. I'm still subject. I think so much. That's why I said I think so much of Mr. Fuller when I read this, because it's just like, wow, this is either he's doing a lot. I don't know if he's read this book, but it does seem like he uses a lot of the suggestions, even staying in the question lane. That was said today's session as well, when Mr. Carnegie was talking about how not to give people demands, but to ask questions or to make suggestions. That sounds like straight code book. Just Jones should be with us as well. Do you want to participate?
Yes. I was thinking about this particular chapter. I'm really finding this book very useful, but this particular part reminded me that this book is, Dale Carnegie is talking to other white people. He's not talking to us, because, I don't know, I was just thinking about when he said people do not like to take orders and ask questions instead of giving direct orders and letting one save face and admitting mistakes. I don't personally know any white people who behave that way towards me. I mean, it makes sense in the sense that I would try to treat people this way, but I think it would be a mistake to kind of universe. Think this kind of, I don't know, behavior can be, white people don't have a regard for black people, so they're not going to treat them this way. So, I don't know. I was just thinking about how this book is Dale Carnegie is talking to other white people. And I tend to kind of make the mistake sometimes when I read kind of books like this, thinking that everyone behaves this way. Like, this is kind of, I don't know. This will be useful information for me to deal with other black people, and even to deal with white people, but I don't see them using this towards me. And I know this book, he said it's common knowledge, which it is, because it's making sense to me, but I'm just thinking about white people and the way that they treat me, and it's not with the level of respect that this book is teaching. So that's all I was thinking about. So. I'm done.
Excellent point, Just Jones. I totally agree. He is definitely, and this was written in 1936. I would say people should keep that in mind as well. 1936 was when this was written. So, I mean, you still had black people being lynched for fun in 1936. I mean, the Trayvon Martin situation is horrific, but I mean, 1936, he could have been killed in the street and it would have been a parade, no trial. They would have sent photographs and postcards as souvenirs of the corpse. That's the type of thing that was still going down in 1936. So absolutely not. They were not talking to white people. And even if this book was written in 2013, I would say the same thing is applicable. Clearly, there's a totally different way that you're supposed to treat, behave with black people. So, yeah.
If this is supposed common knowledge, it kind of proves that they're consciously mistreating us. If they're not treating us with the same level of respect, if this is supposedly common knowledge, I think that's what he said. This book is just writing down what people naturally know. And as I'm listening to it, yeah, it's making sense. You can't criticize people. They won't listen to you. You can't influence people by, you have to point out your mistakes first. But if this is common knowledge, then it goes to show that if they're not treating us this way, that it's kind of conscious and willful on their part. So. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Totally different standard of conduct. And I think white people are extremely aware of that. They know there's a totally different code of conduct for how dark people are supposed to be treated on the planet. Totally different.
You know, that reminds me of another part of the book when he was referring to dogs and the training of dogs and the way you give them a treat when they do something good. And he mentioned B.F. Skinner, which is basically conditioning. And then I keep thinking about that clip that you play that his conditioning has been conditioned. You know, where is that from? Anyway, I meant to ask you. Where does that come from?
It is the clip that I'm playing it from, and I see the other people that dialed in. Shadow, your line should be open. 3978, your line should be open. And it's one of everybody that dialed in with the hand up, your line should be open. But the version of the clip that I'm playing is actually on the Black Star album, because that was mentioned before, with Talib Kweli, Yasiin Bey, formerly known as Mos Def. They have that clip on their album. It's longer, where they're talking about racism, blah, 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 and he goes into all that, and then he goes into the song Brown Skin Lady, talking about how they're going away from the white aesthetic of what beauty means. Incredible album. That's pretty much from beginning to end all about racism, white supremacy. But that clip specifically is from the movie The Chameleon, which is also pretty much about racism, white supremacy, but from beginning to end, where this black guy, he's a victim of racism. And so he's trying to go through life as a victim and being mistreated and not able to get a good job and all this. And so he basically runs from reality. So he tells all these lies and what have you to try to exist, respond to racism, white supremacy. And it follows his life, what happens to him. He keeps getting in trouble, keeps having to deal with racism. I won't tell you the whole thing. I think I put it, if I didn't, that's a big fail on my part, because people had asked me that before and I told them, and I told some other listeners the movie and they watched it. I went back and watched the movie again, and it has a part where the guy who's saying that his conditioning has been conditioned, he's having dinner with his black wife, and this white guy comes up and is like, "Hey, your wife is so fine. Wow, you're such a good looking color guy." I mean, he's just being really vulgar, racist, and he's drunk. So he's just like, "Oh, she's so fine. Look at this colored gal. I want to get some of that. Here, let me, how much would it take to get you home?" And he's like, "What are you talking about? I'm here with my wife. Can you?" He's like, "Shut up, nigga. How much do you need? Here's $20. Here's $50. What do you need for me to sleep with this baboon?" And so she's like, "What?" They're both getting all upset and like, "I mean, how could you be talking to us like this?" And so he stands up and he tries to give this eloquent response where he's using all these huge words and da 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 da. And the white guy's just like, "Nigga, please." And he knocks him out and they take him to the hospital. The whole movie is about racism. I would highly encourage folks to check it out. It's called The Chameleon. It came out in the late 80s. And if I didn't put it on my Facebook page, I'll do it again, because it's online. You can watch it and it's pretty quality version. So I'll knock that out before the program ends. All three of the other people that dialed in with the hand up, your line is open.
As far as the thing about criticism, that's definitely something that right now that racism, white supremacy is so much in the forefront. I'm already starting to see it. I saw posts that were already criticizing President Obama, I mean by black people, that, you know, it's about time and that he was spineless and this and that. And also, I'm not sure exactly what he said, but I heard that Charles Barkley made a statement about the trial, and people seem to be upset about that. So, as you said, we have to really rein in the criticism, or at least control it, because it's going to get from white people and Trayvon to black people on each other. Black on black crime, as they like to say. Because I wasn't serious.
Yep. The other folks that dialed in, your line should be open. You'll probably hear the Charles Barkley sound clip tomorrow. He was talking about black racists, among other things.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
I've been listening to this is 3978, by the way. I've been listening to the audio clips, and it was interesting because I was doing a drive down to Maryland, and I had this playing in the car, one of the clips, during the 4th of July weekend, and my brother made a comment. He doesn't listen to the program or anything like that. And he was like, hey, this audio book sounds like it's just talking about being deceptive. And I was just like, yeah, you're right. This book is pretty much written for white people to practice deception, or how to better practice deception. That's my basis. That's my analysis of the book. I mean, it definitely can help out non-white people and teach them how to, you know, react and to, you know, come together, I guess, with each other and, you know, interact with one another without having conflict. But at the same time, this book was generally written for white people and teaching them how to become better Decepticons, as they say. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, refinement. I think more refined white people, they understand how to control people. They understand that just putting a gun in someone's face is not going to be a long range plan for dominating people for 1,000 years. White people, I think Mr. Fuller says it best, their most effective tool is words. And it's been my experience, white people are very good being able to smile and use their words to get things done and have people confused and going right along with whatever it is that they say, whatever they want done. They are very, very good at that.
Yeah, and I see this book working like a fine tune, like a fine-tuned car at work. I see this book working perfectly with the comments and stuff. Even when I was definitely more confused, I would definitely see how this book works with like the compliments and things like that. But this book has definitely been helpful. You know, makes me pay attention, be aware of certain things that I say, what to say and what not to say. Because, I mean, it's not what you do, it's how you do things for the most part. So that's one of the things that we have to be mindful to. So when we're talking to each other, other victims, you know, so just how you do it. I mean, you can have an idea of what you want to say, but it's how you say it. If you want to say it in a certain tone, you got to remember who your audience is, and you got to know how to approach it and how to say it.
Absolutely. Did we miss? Want to make sure I didn't miss anybody. There should be one other person that dialed in with a hand up.
No, I was just want to mention the same thing that the other gentleman did about B.F. Skinner. I've heard, and I'm not sure if I'm correct, if somebody could correct me, but was some of his techniques used on us to make us more compliant? Is there any, like, legitimate record of that, or?
I had a psych major. B.F. Skinner is one of those white people that you have to know if you're going to get a psych degree. B.F. Skinner, James Watson, got a long, Jung, obviously, Freud. I don't recall any. Well, I might have to go back and do it. It's been a while since I looked, so I could be wrong. I'll just say that. I would say directly, I don't recall off the top of my head where there were some examples, although there may have been. But everything white people learn gets applied to us directly, indirectly anyway. So I'm sure even if you don't find it, you know, written out explicitly where either he did something or someone took principles that he used, said we're going to apply this to non-white people. But I mean, in my view, you can see that. I would say you see that in effect with white people coming out and fussing at Paula Deen and saying, don't call them niggers. That right there is B.F. Skinner, him saying, because that was his whole thing about conditioning behavior was you don't punish, you don't go the punitive route, you go reinforce, positive reinforce. That's what it's called, positive reinforcement. Negative reinforcement is no good. Positive reinforcement is what you want. So you don't want to call them niggers. You want to tell them they're great. African history is wonderful. We have a black president. All of that. There's no racism. Look at you. You black people are doing wonderful. Look at Attorney General Eric Holder. I would say you see it in practice in that way. I'll mute my line.
Yeah, I've heard Dr. Africa speak on B.F. Skinner before in a clip on YouTube. So I'm assuming that, yeah, if Dr. Africa is addressing him, he's definitely speaking on this gentleman or suspected racist about this guy practicing racism. So I mean, I haven't done any in-depth knowledge, but that's the only knowledge I have of someone else speaking on him. So, pretty sure if you do some intense research, you'll find some information on him. I believe you're speaking about projects, about how the setup of like projects and using rats to study on how to keep people in project, like project housing. And that's how, I remember, excuse me, but yeah, I'm just a little fumbled right now, but I remember him in a clip speaking about that, about setting up project buildings and how to use rats as tests to create to create them and have them become dysfunctional amongst each other because they're on top of each other, and you destroy the family like that by having them on top of each other. I may be wrong, but if I could find a clip, maybe I'll pass it on to Gus, and maybe he could play a clip of it. Maybe he could play a soundbite of it.
Right on. Want to make sure we do have time to do the second clip of the audio. If y'all want to get anything else in the last five minutes, anything else before we play a second audio clip?
While we were on B.F. Skinner, didn't he take some of his work from Pavlov's dog? Did he, wasn't that similar, since you're a psych major?
Yep, that's another one that you have to learn, Pavlov's conditioning. Yep, that would be another one, pretty similar. Conditioned responses, conditioned stimulus. Anything else folks wanted to get in before we get to the second segment? Anything else?
That's it for me.
Anybody finds the anything explicit with Mr. Skinner, definitely share. Yeah, I can't recall anything off top. If I find it, I'll share. I did, even though I guess I got one out of two, I did get the link for The Chameleon. That should be on my Facebook page where you can watch it online. It came out in 1989. And I'll also put a link. The filmmaker is a black male, person who came up with it. He did an interview like in the last year or two where he was talking about this film and how it relates to racism. It was like a 30-minute interview. I will post that as well. Folks want to get more information. We will go ahead and start the second segment. Folks did not get a chance to share before we got to this segment. Just hang tight, make a note or what have you, and you can get it in. We should have at least 30 minutes to discuss the final section and any closing thoughts folks want to get in on Mr. Carnegie's work. Context of White Supremacy, Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People. The final segment. You called in, just mute your line to preserve the quality of the program. Context of White Supremacy.
Remember, we all crave appreciation and recognition and will do almost anything to get it. But nobody wants insincerity. Nobody wants flattery. Let me repeat. The principles taught in this book will work only when they come from the heart. I'm not advocating a bag of tricks. I'm talking about a new way of life. Talk about changing people. If you and I will inspire the people with whom we come in contact to a realization of the hidden treasures they possess, we can do far more than change people. We can literally transform them. Exaggeration? Then listen to these sage words from William James, one of the most distinguished psychologists and philosophers America has ever produced. Compared with what we ought to be, we are only half awake. We are making use of only a small part of our physical and mental resources. Stating the thing broadly, the human individual thus lives far within his limits. He possesses powers of various sorts which he habitually fails to use. Yes, you possess powers of various sorts which you habitually fail to use. And one of these powers you are probably not using to the fullest extent is your magic ability to praise people and inspire them with a realization of their latent possibilities. Abilities wither under criticism, they blossom under encouragement. To become a more effective leader of people, apply Principle 6. Praise the slightest improvement and praise every improvement. Be hearty in your approbation and lavish in your praise. Chapter 7. Give a dog a good name. What do you do when a person who's been a good worker begins to turn in shoddy work? You can fire him or her, but that really doesn't solve anything. You can berate the worker, but this usually causes resentment. Henry Henke, a service manager for a large truck dealership in Lowell, Indiana, had a mechanic whose work had become less than satisfactory. Instead of bawling him out or threatening him, Mr. Henke called him into his office and had a heart-to-heart talk with him. "Bill," he said, "you're a fine mechanic. You've been in this line of work for a good number of years. You've repaired many vehicles to the customer's satisfaction. In fact, we've had a number of compliments about the good work you've done. Yet of late the time you take to complete each job has been increasing, and your work has not been up to your own old standards. Because you've been such an outstanding mechanic in the past, I felt sure you'd want to know that I'm not happy with the situation. Perhaps jointly we could find some way to correct the problem." Bill responded that he hadn't realized he'd been falling down in his duties, and assured his boss that the work he was getting was not out of his range of expertise, and that he would try to improve in the future. Did he do it? You can be sure he did. He once again became a fast and thorough mechanic. With that reputation Mr. Henke had given him to live up to, how could he do anything else but turn out work comparable to that which he had done in the past? "The average person," said Samuel Vauclain, then president of the Baldwin Locomotive Works, "can be led readily if you have his or her respect, and if you show that you respect that person for some kind of ability. In short, if you want to improve a person in a certain respect, act as though that particular trait were already one of his or her outstanding characteristics. Shakespeare said, 'Assume a virtue if you have it not.' And it might be well to assume and state openly that other people have the virtue you want them to develop. Give them a fine reputation to live up to, and they will make prodigious efforts rather than see you disillusioned." Georgette LeBlanc, in her book Souvenirs, My Life with Maeterlinck, describes the startling transformation of a humble Belgian Cinderella. "A servant girl from a neighboring hotel brought my meals," she wrote. She was called Marie the Dishwasher because she had started her career as a scullery assistant. She was a kind of monster, cross-eyed, bandy-legged, poor in flesh and spirit. One day, while she was holding my plate of macaroni in her red hand, I said to her point blank, "Marie, you do not know what treasures are within you." Accustomed to holding back her emotion, Marie waited a few moments, not daring to risk the slightest gesture for fear of a catastrophe. Then she put the dish on the table, sighed, and said ingenuously, "Madame, I would never have believed it." She did not doubt, she did not ask a question, she simply went back to the kitchen and repeated what I had said. And such is the force of faith that no one made fun of her. From that day on, she was even given a certain consideration. But the most curious change of all occurred in the humble Marie herself. Believing she was the tabernacle of unseen marvels, she began taking care of her face and body so carefully that her starved youth seemed to bloom and modestly hide her plainness. 2 months later, she announced her coming marriage with the nephew of the chef. "I'm going to be a lady," she said, and thanked me. A small phrase had changed her entire life. Georgette LeBlanc had given Marie the dishwasher a reputation to live up to, and that reputation had transformed her. Bill Parker, a sales representative for a food company in Daytona Beach, Florida, was very excited about the new line of products his company was introducing, and was upset when the manager of a large independent food market turned down the opportunity to carry it in his store. Bill brooded all day over this rejection and decided to return to the store before he went home that evening and try again. "Jack," he said, "since I left this morning, I realized I hadn't given you the entire picture of our new line, and I'd appreciate some of your time to tell you about the points I omitted. I've respected the fact that you're always willing to listen and are big enough to change your mind when the facts warrant a change." Could Jack refuse to give him another hearing? Not with that reputation to live up to. One morning, Dr. Martin Fitzhugh, a dentist in Dublin, Ireland, was shocked when one of his patients pointed out to him that the metal cup holder which she was using to rinse her mouth was not very clean. True, the patient drank from the paper cup, not the holder, but it certainly was not professional to use tarnished equipment. When the patient left, Dr. Fitzhugh retreated to his private office to write a note to Bridget, the charwoman, who came twice a week to clean his office. He wrote, "My dear Bridget, I see you so seldom, I thought I'd take the time to thank you for the fine job of cleaning you've been doing. By the way, I thought I'd mention that since 2 hours twice a week is a very limited amount of time, please feel free to work an extra half hour from time to time if you feel the need to do those once-in-a-while things like polishing the cup holders and the like. I, of course, will pay you for the extra time." The next day, when I walked into my office, Dr. Fitzhugh reported, my desk had been polished to a mirror-like finish, as had my chair, which I nearly slid out of. When I went into the treatment room, I found the shiniest, cleanest, chrome-plated cup holder I had ever seen nestled in its receptacle. I had given my charwoman a fine reputation to live up to, and because of this small gesture, she outperformed all her past efforts. How much additional time did she spend on this? That's right, none at all. There's an old saying, give a dog a bad name and you may as well hang him, but give him a good name and see what happens. When Mrs. Ruth Hopkins, a fourth-grade teacher in Brooklyn, New York, looked at her class roster the first day of school, her excitement and joy of starting a new term was tinged with anxiety. In her class this year, she would have Tommy T., the school's most notorious bad boy. He was not just mischievous. He caused serious discipline problems in the class, picked fights with the boys, teased the girls, was fresh to the teacher, and seemed to get worse as he grew older. His only redeeming feature was his ability to learn rapidly and master the schoolwork easily. Mrs. Hopkins decided to face the Tommy problem immediately. When she greeted her new students, she made little comments to each of them. "Rose, that's a pretty dress you're wearing. Alicia, I hear you draw beautifully." And when she came to Tommy, she looked him straight in the eyes and said, "Tommy, I understand you're a natural leader. I'm going to depend on you to help me make this class the best class in the fourth grade this year." She reinforced this over the first few days by complimenting Tommy on everything he did and commenting on how this showed what a good student he was. With that reputation to live up to, even a 9-year-old couldn't let her down, and he didn't. If you want to excel in that difficult leadership role of changing the attitude or behavior of others, use Principle 7. Give the other person a fine reputation to live up to. Chapter 8. Make the fault seem easy to correct. A bachelor friend of mine, about 40 years old, became engaged, and his fiancée persuaded him to take some belated dancing lessons. "The Lord knows I needed dancing lessons," he confessed as he told me the story, "for I danced just as I did when I first started 20 years ago. The first teacher I engaged probably told me the truth. She said I was all wrong. I would just have to forget everything and begin all over again. But that took the heart out of me. I had no incentive to go on, so I quit her. The next teacher may have been lying, but I liked it. She said nonchalantly that my dancing was a bit old-fashioned, perhaps, but the fundamentals were all right, and she assured me I wouldn't have any trouble learning a few new steps. The first teacher had discouraged me by emphasizing my mistakes. This new teacher did the opposite. She kept praising the things I did right and minimizing my errors. 'You have a natural sense of rhythm,' she assured me. 'You really are a natural-born dancer.' and now my common sense tells me that I always have been and always will be a fourth-rate dancer, yet deep in my heart I still like to think that maybe she meant it. To be sure, I was paying her to say it, but why bring that up? At any rate, I know I'm a better dancer than I would have been if she hadn't told me I had a natural sense of rhythm. That encouraged me. That gave me hope. That made me want to improve. Tell your child, your spouse, or your employee that he or she is stupid or dumb at a certain thing, has no gift for it, and is doing it all wrong, and you have destroyed almost every incentive to try to improve. But use the opposite technique. Be liberal with your encouragement. Make the thing seem easy to do. Let the other person know that you have faith in his ability to do it, that he has an undeveloped flair for it, and he will practice until the dawn comes in the window in order to excel. Lowell Thomas, a superb artist in human relations, used this technique. He gave you confidence, inspired you with courage and faith. For example, I spent a weekend with Mr. and Mrs. Thomas, and on Saturday night I was asked to sit in on a friendly bridge game before a roaring fire. Bridge? Oh, no, 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 not me. I knew nothing about it. The game had always been a black mystery to me. No, no, impossible. Why, Dale, it's no trick at all, Lowell replied. There's nothing to bridge except memory and judgment. You've written articles on memory. Bridge will be a cinch for you. It's right up your alley. And presto, almost before I realized what I was doing, I found myself for the first time at a bridge table, all because I was told I had a natural flair for it, and the game was made to seem easy. Speaking of bridge reminds me of Eli Culbertson, whose books on bridge have been translated into a dozen languages and have sold more than 1 million copies. Yet he told me he never would have made a profession out of the game if a certain young woman hadn't assured him that he had a flair for it. When he came to America in 1922, he tried to get a job teaching in philosophy and sociology, but he couldn't. Then he tried selling coal, and he failed at that. Then he tried selling coffee, and he failed at that, too. He had played some bridge, but it had never occurred to him in those days that someday he would teach it. He was not only a poor card player, but he was also very stubborn. He asked so many questions and held so many post-mortem examinations that no one wanted to play with him. Then he met a pretty bridge teacher, Josephine Dillon, fell in love and married her. She noticed how carefully he analyzed his cards and persuaded him that he was a potential genius at the card table. It was that encouragement and that alone, Culbertson told me, that caused him to make a profession of bridge. Clarence M. Jones, one of the instructors of our course in Cincinnati, Ohio, told how encouragement and making faults seem easy to correct completely changed the life of his son. In 1970, my son David, who was then 15 years old, came to live with me in Cincinnati. He had led a rough life. In 1958, his head was cut open in a car accident, leaving a very bad scar on his forehead. In 1960, his mother and I were divorced, and he moved to Dallas, Texas, with his mother. Until he was 15, he'd spent most of his school years in special classes for slow learners in the Dallas school system. Possibly because of the scar, school administrators decided that he was brain injured and could not function at a normal level. He was 2 years behind his age group, so he was only in the 7th grade. Yet he did not know his multiplication tables, added on his fingers, and could barely read. There was one positive point. He loved to work on radio and TV sets. He wanted to become a TV technician. I encouraged this and pointed out that he needed math to qualify for the training. I decided to help him become proficient in this subject. We obtained 4 sets of flashcards, multiplication, division, addition, and subtraction. As we went through the cards, we put the correct answers in a discard stack. When David missed one, I gave him the correct answer and then put the card in the repeat stack until there were no cards left. I made a big deal out of each card he got right, particularly if he had missed it previously. Each night, we would go through the repeat stack until there were no cards left. Each night, we timed the exercise with a stopwatch. I promised him that when he could get all the cards correct in 8 minutes with no incorrect answers, we would quit doing it every night. Now, this seemed an impossible goal to David. The first night it took 52 minutes. The second night, 48, then 45, 44, 41, then under 40 minutes. We celebrated each reduction. I'd call in my wife, and we would both hug him, and we'd dance a jig. At the end of the month, he was doing all the cards perfectly in less than 8 minutes. When he made a small improvement, he would ask to do it again. He had made the fantastic discovery that learning was easy and fun. Naturally, his grades in algebra took a jump. It is amazing how much easier algebra is when you can multiply. He astonished himself by bringing home a B in math. That had never happened before. Other changes came with almost unbelievable rapidity. His reading improved rapidly, and he began to use his natural talents in drawing. Later in the school year, his science teacher assigned him to develop an exhibit. He chose to develop a highly complex series of models to demonstrate the effect of levers. It required skill not only in drawing and model making, but in applied mathematics. The exhibit took first prize in his school science fair and was entered in the city competition and won third prize for the entire city of Cincinnati. That did it. Here was a kid who had flunked two grades, who had been told he was brain damaged, who had been called Frankenstein by his classmates, and told his brains must have leaked out of the cut on his head. Suddenly he discovered he could really learn and accomplish things. The result? From the last quarter of the eighth grade all the way through high school, he never failed to make the honor roll. In high school, he was elected to the National Honor Society. Once he found learning was easy, his whole life changed. If you want to help others to improve, remember Principle 8. Use encouragement. Make the fault seem easy to correct. Chapter 9. Making People Glad to Do What You Want. Back in 1915, America was aghast. For more than a year, the nations of Europe had been slaughtering one another on a scale never before dreamed of in all the bloody annals of mankind. Could peace be brought about? No one knew. But Woodrow Wilson was determined to try. He would send a personal representative, a peace emissary, to counsel with the warlords of Europe. William Jennings Bryan, Secretary of State, Bryan, the peace advocate, longed to go. He saw a chance to perform a great service and make his name immortal. But Wilson appointed another man, his intimate friend and advisor, Colonel Edward M. House, and it was House's thorny task to break the unwelcome news to Bryan without giving him offense. Bryan was distinctly disappointed when he heard I was to go to Europe as the peace emissary, Colonel House records in his diary. He said he had planned to do this himself. I replied that the president thought it would be unwise for anyone to do this officially, and that his going would attract a great deal of attention, and people would wonder why he was there. You see the intimation? House practically told Bryan that he was too important for the job, and Bryan was satisfied. Colonel House, adroit, experienced in the ways of the world, was following one of the important rules of human relations. Always make the other person happy about doing the thing you suggest. Woodrow Wilson followed that policy even when inviting William Gibbs McAdoo to become a member of his cabinet. That was the highest honor he could confer upon anyone, and yet Wilson extended the invitation in such a way as to make McAdoo feel doubly important. Here's the story, in McAdoo's own words. Wilson said that he was making up his cabinet and that he would be very glad if I would accept a place in it as Secretary of the Treasury. He had a delightful way of putting things. He created the impression that by accepting this great honor, I would be doing him a favor. Unfortunately, Wilson didn't always employ such tact. If he had, history might have been different. For example, Wilson didn't make the Senate and the Republican Party happy by entering the United States in the League of Nations. Wilson refused to take such prominent Republican leaders as Elihu Root or Charles Evans Hughes or Henry Cabot Lodge to the peace conference with him. Instead, he took along unknown men from his own party. He snubbed the Republicans, refused to let them feel that the League was their idea as well as his, refused to let them have a finger in the pie, and as a result of this crude handling of human relations, wrecked his own career, ruined his health, shortened his life, caused America to stay out of the league, and altered the history of the world. Statesmen and diplomats aren't the only ones who use this make a person happy to do the things you want them to do approach. Dale O. Ferrier of Fort Wayne, Indiana, told how he encouraged one of his young children to willingly do the chore he was assigned. One of Jeff's chores was to pick up pears from under the pear tree so the person who was mowing underneath wouldn't have to stop and pick them up. He didn't like this chore, and frequently it was either not done at all or it was done so poorly that the mower had to stop and pick up several pears that he'd missed. Rather than have an eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation about it, one day I said to him, "Jeff, I'll make a deal with you. For every bushel basket full of pears you pick up, I'll pay you $1. But after you're finished, for every pear I find left in the yard, I'll take away $1. How does that sound?" As you'd expect, he not only picked up all of the pears, but I had to keep an eye on him to see that he didn't pull a few off the trees to fill up some of the baskets. I knew a man who had to refuse many invitations to speak, invitations extended by friends, invitations coming from people to whom he was obligated, and yet he did it so adroitly that the other person was at least contented with his refusal. How did he do it? Not by merely talking about the fact that he was too busy and too this and too that. No, after expressing his appreciation of the invitation and regretting his inability to accept it, he suggested a substitute speaker. In other words, he didn't give the other person any time to feel unhappy about the refusal. He immediately changed the other person's thoughts to some other speaker who could accept the invitation. Gunter Schmidt, who took our course in West Germany, told of an employee in the food store he managed who was negligent about putting the proper price tags on the shelves where the items were displayed. This caused confusion and customer complaints. Reminders, admonitions, confrontations with her about this did not do much good. Finally, Mr. Schmidt called her into his office and told her he was appointing her supervisor of price tag posting for the entire store, and she would be responsible for keeping all of the shelves properly tagged. This new responsibility and title changed her attitude completely, and she fulfilled her duties satisfactorily from then on. Childish? Perhaps. But that is what they said to Napoleon when he created the Legion of Honor and distributed 15,000 crosses to his soldiers and made 18 of his generals marshals of France and called his troops the Grand Army. Napoleon was criticized for giving toys to war-hardened veterans, and Napoleon replied, "Men are ruled by toys." This technique of giving titles and authority worked for Napoleon, and it will work for you. For example, a friend of mine, Mrs. Ernest Gent of Scarsdale, New York, was troubled by boys running across and destroying her lawn. She tried criticism, she tried coaxing, neither worked. Then she tried giving the worst sinner in the gang a title and a feeling of authority. She made him her detective and put him in charge of keeping all trespassers off her lawn. That solved her problem. Her detective built a bonfire in the backyard, heated an iron red hot, and threatened to brand any boy who stepped on the lawn. The effective leader should keep the following guidelines in mind when it's necessary to change attitudes or behavior. 1. Be sincere. Do not promise anything that you cannot deliver. Forget about the benefits to yourself and concentrate on the benefits to the other person. 2. Know exactly what it is you want the other person to do. 3. Be empathetic. Ask yourself what it is the other person really wants. 4. Consider the benefits that person will receive from doing what you suggest. 5. Match those benefits to the other person's wants. And 6. When you make your request, put it in a form that will convey to the other person the idea that he personally will benefit. We could give a curt order like this: "John, we have customers coming in tomorrow, and I need the stock room cleaned out. So sweep it out, put the stock in neat piles on the shelves, and polish the counter." Or we could express the same idea by showing John the benefits he will get from doing the task. John, we have a job that should be completed right away. If it's done now, we won't be faced with it later. I'm bringing some customers in tomorrow to show our facilities. I'd like to show them the stockroom, but it is in poor shape. If you could sweep it out, put the stock in neat piles on the shelves, and polish the counter, it would make us look efficient, and you will have done your part to provide a good company image. Will John be happy about doing what you suggest? Probably not very happy, but happier than if you had not pointed out the benefits. Assuming you know that John has pride in the way his stockroom looks and is interested in contributing to the company image, he will be more likely to be cooperative. It will also have been pointed out to John that the job would have to be done eventually, and by doing it now, he won't be faced with it later. It is naive to believe you will always get a favorable reaction from other persons when you use these approaches, but the experience of most people shows that you are more likely to change attitudes this way than by not using these principles. And if you increase your successes by even a mere 10%, you have become 10% more effective as a leader than you were before. And that is your benefit. People are more likely to do what you would like them to do when you use Principle 9. Make the other person happy about doing the thing you suggest. In a nutshell, be a leader. A leader's job often includes changing your people's attitudes and behavior. Some suggestions to accomplish this. Principle 1. Begin with praise and honest appreciation. Principle 2. Call attention to people's mistakes indirectly. Principle 3. Talk about your own mistakes before criticizing the other person. Principle 4. Ask questions instead of giving direct orders. Principle 5. Let the other person save face. Principle 6. Praise the slightest improvement and praise every improvement. Be hearty in your approbation and lavish in your praise. Principle 7. Give the other person a fine reputation to live up to. Principle 8. Use encouragement. Make the fault seem easy to correct. Principle 9. Make the other person happy about doing the thing you suggest.
This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Context of white supremacy. The audiobook does not have the last section. The book that I have has the one more chapter. It's about writing letters. You can check that out. Always interesting with words. He actually has some examples, too, that you can check out. That's you can check it out. If you anyone that doesn't have the book, I figure this is an easy book to get your hands on. If you don't have the book, or if you would like the PDFs, you can check out Part 5 about letters and writing letters. Let me know, and I'll put it on my Facebook page or tweet it or whatever the case may be. The number is 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-pound. I forgot we started a little bit late today, so we have a little bit more time. My quick comment before I get to the folks who dialed in, as the caller pointed out, that for white people, this is refined deception for them, because white people don't mind mistreating other white people. So this is, hey, I am a terrorist. There is no moral compass. I can do whatever I want. I'm white man, white woman, white child, do whatever I want. But I want to be crafty. I can't have everybody thinking of me as some super deceptive person. So absolutely, this is how this is going to be used in the system of racism, white supremacy. I'm sure we can all think of examples of phony white people that we've been around who are very good at using words and making it seem like they're being Timothy Wise. Anywho, I would emphasize that with non-white people, I hope we don't use these suggestions as game, a means to be deceptive of other victims. As he says, even in the book, Racist Suspect, Mr. Carnegie, that you do not want to be insincere with these techniques. He says it over and over again, even though he's white. And I mean, he's quoting killers, Abraham Lincoln, racist. So there's no reason for me to be to think that this is someone who is not a racist. But at least as it applies to us and victims of racism, sincerity, when patiently listening to others, not criticizing, praising, recognizing them, commending their efforts, it should be sincere. It shouldn't just be, oh, I'm doing this because I know this will work and I can get what I want. Like, it really should be in the spirit of doing the correct thing to another victim of racism. And also, just with the emphasis, the impact, I hope all of us, you know, don't need too much convincing, but just the huge impact that what people say to you, how that can influence what you, like you heard him keep saying in the book, where just a little bit of praise changed his life or changed someone else's life. Conversely, with victims of racism, I don't know how many people are familiar with Jim Brown. He's a Hall of Fame NFL football player, used to be. He had his jersey retired at the University of Syracuse. If you go to Syracuse, if you go to the school in the Carrier Dome, they, well, I don't know if it's called the Carrier Dome, but if you go in the dome at Syracuse, you'll see where they have like a little shrine to Jim Brown with all of his lacrosse and football. They retired, I think, both of his jerseys at Syracuse. He is, I think, undisputed, regarded as the best football player to ever play at Syracuse and the best lacrosse player, because white people at least now give the image that no black people, no non-white people play lacrosse. I don't even think it's disputed at Syracuse who's the best all-time Syracuse lacrosse player there, being Jim Brown. Jim Brown, if you watch Spike Lee's documentary film, Jim Brown All-American, Jim Brown almost quit playing football because of racism, because he was criticized. They didn't allow him to play, just to totally undermine your self-esteem, your self-respect. Somebody who went on to become, this is almost not really disputed too much either, to become one of the greatest football players of all time. And this is someone who almost quit at 18, 19 years old because of racism and being criticized, being critiqued. Can't play this. Niggas can't do this. Blah, blah, blah. And he's just playing with a whole team full of racists. I think it was, he was the only black person on the team, or it was only a handful of them at that time. So just to kind of keep that in mind, the huge damage, the huge impact that words can have, and particularly for black people, because I can guarantee you with a black person, any black person, it's not just going to be one bad thing said about them. It's going to be a whole legion of bad things and critiques today, yesterday, your whole experience, and then generational. So really just kind of keep that in mind and monitoring what we're saying about other black people, other victims of racism, including ourselves. The folks that dialed in, everybody's line should be open since there are several folks who dialed in. If there's anyone who did not get to participate at all during the first part of the dialogue, if you want to go first, anybody that did not get to share at all, you want to go first?
Peace, can I be heard?
Greetings, B. Moore. Good to hear from you.
Greetings, Gus, and all the other listeners. This will be real quick. I just want to say constructive book as well as constructive study session. And the only thing I had to touch on was the last one that the audiobook shared about making a person happy about doing the thing that you suggest. By giving them a title and feeling of authority. The children at my former place of employment, I gave them jobs, and after giving them jobs, they would sort of, for lack of better words, police themselves. I would give them jobs pertaining to things they were having issues with, like being quiet in the hallway. I would make a hall monitor, or cleaning up after themselves and stuff like that. I would make like a custodial job or something like that, and I had badges and everything, and we would alternate weekly, and they really enjoyed that, and it, again, for lack of better words, they policed themselves and started doing better at things they had problems with. But, yes, I see a lot of school systems do that. I do think that's very important with me working with children. That's all for now.
Mm-hmm. any of the folks.
Greetings. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Greetings, Gus, and to the listeners. Just wanted to say that this book is very powerful, very constructive read, and, I mean, if you use this, I mean, it's like a tool. Like, you can use it to hurt someone or to help someone. As long as, you know, just like the book says, if you're sincere in trying to make other people feel good about themselves, you know, there's really no harm in that. And if you're sincere about it and you get benefits from it, I mean, this book can change your life, really. I mean, I read this book years ago and used some of the techniques in it, you know, sporadically, and it works. When you make other people feel good about themselves, you know, it disarms them. And you can get places where you normally wouldn't be able to get into without using these techniques. And it's kind of like hypnosis, and if you use it correctly.
Anybody else have feedback, comments?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I was just to piggyback off what the other caller was saying. The book does seem to be pretty powerful if, you know, used correctly. But, you know, I was thinking some of these principles and techniques that you use, eventually there's going to have to be some type of reward given. In other words, like, for instance, if, like, the woman that was unattractive and someone told her that, you know, she looked good or whatever, then, I mean, it had an astonishing effect upon the way she felt about herself. But then, like I said, later she became engaged with a young man. What I'm trying to say is you can use the principles, but there has to be some type of results, a positive result from it, you know, at some period of time before it's affected. That's all I have to say.
Any other thoughts?
Well, being a leader, you know, this book kind of insinuates that, you know, in other words, like, anyone can be a leader, but I don't think that's true. The way that I look at things, if it's something that we're doing, some project or some type of job, to me, the leader is the person that is most efficient in what it is that we're doing. And if he knows, if he's proficient in what he's doing, and he's knowledgeable about what he's undertaking, then he automatically rises to the top and becomes the leader. It's not, you know, you may have some hidden attributes that you don't know about, but someone that is a follower or that don't have the incentive or the knowledge and abilities, regardless of what techniques he used, he can never become an effective leader. I think somewhere it said, leaders are born and not made. And I think to some extent that's true. Although I think that everyone can improve and everyone can be better at what they're doing. You can always get better, no matter how good you are at doing something. So a lot of these principles, too, came from defects that people have. Sometimes you have to identify the defects. It's hard to identify defects that you have within yourself, but I asked a guy once, you know, how can you know what your defects are? And he said, well, just listen, people are telling you what your defects are. So it's, you know, abundance of information. You know, if it's to criticize or give you some type of negative feedback, but not that much in the positive sense. So I think if nothing else, this book helps us to understand that a little bit of positive reinforcement will probably go a long way. And I'll mute my line.
And I too know that positive reinforcement works. I'm now an employee at a child and family services center, and they really big on like positive reinforcement and not telling a child what they can't do or what they shouldn't do, but tell them, you know, what you want them to do. And I've seen that it works. Positive reinforcement works.
Mm-hmm. I have as well. I'm going to share a little bit, that I'll mute my line. If other folks want to participate, press star 6 if you're listening in. This is from the section that was not in the audiobook on having a happy home life. It's number 2, the major rule that is in this section, not nagging, which I would just say, you could say not criticizing. And this does not seem to be gender specific, seems to be both ways, not nagging. I may commit many follies in life, Disraeli said, but I never intend to marry for love. And he didn't. He stayed single until he was 35, and then he proposed to a rich widow, 15 years his senior, a widow whose hair was white with the passing of 50 winters. Love? Oh, no. She knew he didn't love her. She knew he was marrying her for her money. So she just made one request. She asked him to wait a year to give her the opportunity to study his character, and at the end of that time, she married him. Sounds pretty prosaic, pretty commercial, doesn't it? Yet, paradoxically enough, Disraeli's marriage was one of the most glowing successes in all the battered and bespattered annals of matrimony. The rich widow that Disraeli chose was neither young nor beautiful nor brilliant. Far from it. Her conversation bubbled with a laugh-provoking display of literary and historical blunders. For example, she never knew which came first, the Greeks or the Romans. Frame of reference, racism, white supremacy. Her taste in clothes was bizarre, and her taste in house furnishings was fantastic. But she was a genius, a positive genius, at the most important thing in marriage, the art of handling men. She didn't attempt to set up her intellect against Disraeli's. When he came home bored and exhausted after an afternoon of matching repartee with witty duchesses, Mary Ann's frivolous patter permitted him to relax. Home, to his increasing delight, was a place where he could ease into his mental slippers and bask in the warmth of Mary Ann's adoration. These hours he spent at home with his aging wife were the happiest of his life. She was his helpmate, his confidant, his advisor. Every night he hurried home from the House of Commons to tell her the day's news, and, this is important, whatever he undertook. Mary Ann simply did not believe he could fail. For 30 years, Mary Ann lived for Disraeli and for him alone. Even her wealth she valued only because it made his life easier. In return, she was his heroine. He became an earl after she died, but even while he was still a commoner, he persuaded Queen Victoria to elevate Mary Anne to the peerage. And so in 1868, she was made Viscountess Beaconsfield. No matter how silly or scatterbrained she might appear in public, he never criticized her. He never uttered a word of reproach. And if anyone dared to ridicule her, he sprang to her defense with ferocious loyalty. Mary Anne wasn't perfect, yet for three decades, she never tired of talking about her husband, praising him, admiring him. Result, we have been married 30 years, Disraeli said, and I have never been bored by her. I will stop there. Just once again, even in personal relationships, partnerships, the importance of not getting into the criticizing. He calls it nagging, criticizing, either or. I'll mute my line. If anyone else has thoughts, feel free.
There was also a part in the book where the a married couple and the woman would go out and work in the yard, and the guy would make comments like, well, it still don't look any better after you spend all that time out there. And it was discouraging, but I guess somehow he became enlightened, and he started to pitch in with her and do little things to help beautify the yard. And just that small bit even improved his relationship just by pitching in and helping in the yard. I guess it goes to say that some cooperation and not criticizing, but pitching in and praising, you know, probably go a long way.
We have about 10 minutes left in the broadcast. The folks that are online, everybody that dialed in with the hand up line should be open. Anybody else have anything they wanted to get in?
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I know you said that there was a last chapter on writing letters, and I think that writing letters is very key. Like, for instance, like birthday letters, birthday cards. Instead of using birthday cards like Hallmark cards, use blank cards and just write how you feel to somebody. That'll go a long way instead of using those Hallmark, already pre-written cards or like get well cards and so on and so forth. I think writing letters definitely helps, especially if you're sincere about it.
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent suggestion. I've heard that repeated over and over again from many folks, particularly now where everything is text and email and all this other stuff. To actually get like a handwritten letter can have a big impact, especially if you're not writing to curse the person out, to tell them what they did wrong, but to say something nice, say something constructive, that generally is going to be a major victory.
Yeah, even for a job interview, especially after you do, you know, send them a nice little thank you letter, allowing you to do the interview, that may land you the job. Hello?
Oh, we can hear you. Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Oh, no. I just spoke. I don't know if anyone heard me.
Oh, yeah. We heard that, too. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. All right. That's all I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
I'll keep my line.
Right on.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, if we could have a little dialogue on President Obama's recent speech, what you started the program off with. I think it was, you know, personally, the way it affected me was it kind of restored a little confidence. I was losing confidence in his, you know, leadership abilities as far as, you know, addressing some of the concerns that non-white and black people have in this country. One of the most important events of my lifetime, I think, was him being elected president. And I was, I kind of wanted him to, you know, at least try to do something to alleviate some of the pain and some of the disparities and just downright atrocities that black people are enduring in this country. And something, you know, short of, you know, just returning, you know, violence for violence, because we know that that's not the answer. But, I mean, and you are, by him being in a leadership position, you know, I think it was his responsibility to at least say something and implement some type of effort to bring about some of this change that he was talking about when he was running for the position. I felt kind of proud of it, actually.
Did anybody else have any thoughts they wanted to get in on what President Obama had to say earlier today? Which was unscheduled, from what I understand, unless I have been misinformed. Some of the news reports that I heard later on in the day after he had finished with the speech, they emphasized that was not scheduled, that he decided he was just going to come out. He didn't take any questions. He just came out and decided he wanted to share, so they say. That may or may not be true, and it could have been ghostwritten. But anybody else have any thoughts on what they wanted to say?
Can we hear it?
Yes, sir.
I think the main thing that he did well in that speech was he acknowledged Trayvon's humanity, and he acknowledged the problems that black people face in this country. I think those two things, to hear him say that, maybe will be some bit of a boost for some black people. I think Trayvon's parents appreciated it, if no one else.
Yeah, I was surprised. The first time that I heard of what he said today, I turned to CBS online. I went to their site, and they had the video, but they had an edited 5-minute version. And so I listened the first time on their site thinking that, oh, he came out and he talked for 5 minutes on Trayvon Martin. And their condensed version, they kind of hit some of the major highlights. And I was just like, wow, I think this is third, maybe fourth time that I have heard since he's been in the White House where he's come out and publicly spoken about racism, white supremacy. I think I can count them all off. I think when he made the comment about Dr. Gates, that would be a cowbell. When he made the comment last year about Trayvon Martin, and I think he had made a brief statement this past weekend over the verdict. So, yeah, I guess this would be the fourth time, unless I missed one, where he's been directly talking about racism, white supremacy that I can think of publicly. So I was surprised. My immediate thought was he's going to get in trouble, like regardless of, you know, what you think about it or whatever. I think there are going to be a significant chunk of white people who are furious about this. And I've already seen evidence that that is. I tweeted some of the responses. Resent them. My Twitter is at Until Justice. I retweeted what some of the white people were saying. NPR, they even had, I put that on my Facebook as well. NPR did a segment that President Obama showed his brother card today. And they had that in quotation marks. So, yeah, I would just say kind of pay attention to see how white people respond to it. I think, unfortunately, I have also seen some individuals that are non-white black people who've also complained, which is tough. When I spoke to Dr. Welsing, she was watching the speech when I first called her, and then I called her back and she'd seen it. And she said she appreciated him having the courage to come out and begin the dialogue, having the courage to honestly confront the reality of racism, white supremacy. And she said that it is our job to continue the dialogue, continue the work, not to complain about what he said or what we like about what he said or what have you, but to continue the effort. But she said that she hopes more of us had the courage to honestly address the problem of white supremacy, racism. But it was, yeah, it was quite, at least they surprised. I was not, I thought that was it. I wasn't expecting him to say anything else about the matter other than the little bit that he had said earlier this week after the verdict, but nearly 17 minutes. And the one part that I thought, wow, when he said, everybody that's down for the stand your ground, you know, if you will take a moment to ponder if Trayvon Martin had been of age and armed, how you would have felt if he had stood his ground and returned fire at George Zimmerman or maybe even killed George Zimmerman, if you all would be saying, yeah, we still want stand your ground. We should all have the right to bear arms and defend ourselves. You shouldn't have to retreat if you are confronted with danger. I said, wow, I have heard victims of racism make a similar point. Even some people who called into this program who said the same thing. Why couldn't Trayvon Martin stand his ground? Why couldn't he defend himself? I thought that was important. I even heard some white people say, good point. Good point.
I even think that basically it wasn't a thing where Zimmerman was standing his ground. He actually stalked this young man and, I mean, the stand your ground law really didn't even apply to this case. The people, law enforcement, told him not to get out of the car. He decided to stalk him, and he chased him down. I mean, that's not standing your ground. So I don't know how the prosecutors put it together, or how the defense or prosecutors put it together that this is stand your ground. This case had nothing to do with that.
Well, I think later on Al Sharpton's show, he played a segment of the trial. Well, no, I take that back. It was what one of the jurors said after the trial, that the George Zimmerman had a right to stand his ground. And then it went into that type of commentary. You know, although they didn't use that type of defense, that evidently affected the jurors. And then later on, several of the other jurors said that they did not agree with what the one said. But I think that did have an impact on how they made their decision. And Al Sharpton had a very good show, you know, illustrating that shortly after President Obama spoke.
Now, if Trayvon had gotten in the car with Zimmerman and attacked him, then to me that's stand your ground. But to get out of your car and chase someone down and stalk him, that's the only one who could have stood his ground would have been Trayvon Martin.
I don't want to go back to replay the whole trial. Actually, I've been thinking about this week. I'm not sure It could be that white people are keeping this in the news, I think, for the depression factor, because it does seem like I've heard a lot of black people. I normally don't hear black people saying that they feel weak and depressed, and I've heard a lot of that the last 7 days with seeing that every day. And it just hasn't, I didn't watch the trial. I mean, it's terrible what happened. It's terrible. But, I mean, this is every day. In fact, I was saying the way that these people, what they're saying with regards to how they feel, I feel like that every day. I felt like that every day my whole life. Like, that's the reason that this exists. And I think that it's dangerous to just get stuck in that spot where you're just mired in, oh, I'm depressed, and oh, this is so sad, or oh, I'm so frustrated, or oh, I'm impotent, and I don't know what to do. I think that's just a very weak position to be in, and I feel like that's what white people want. I think that's why they're keeping this in the news. And even, in fact, one of our listeners, she posted a link where some black, I don't know what part of the world this was in, but they were out, black people were out marching, doing whatever, they weren't doing anything illegal, responding to racism. And these two white guys come up, and one of them has a shirt. I wish they had held the camera because I couldn't read. It was like a sentence, but it had nigger. This white guy was wearing a black t-shirt with white letters, and it had nigger in huge letters across the front of the shirt. It was two of them. And the black people were like, you know, what is this? What are you all doing? And the white guys, it was just the two of them. And so they're just there, and they're like, you know, we're just here exercising our First Amendment right, freedom of speech. We're not doing anything wrong. They said, okay. They were super codified. These black people, they were so codified. They didn't get upset. They weren't cursing them. Nobody went to smack them or fight or anything. They were just like, what are you doing? Like, I'm just trying to understand. And so eventually these white guys, they go get in their car to leave. And it's a black person with a camera, like he's videotaping. He goes over and he's like, I think he says that exactly. I'm just trying to understand, what are you doing here? What is your presence? What are you trying to accomplish? And the white guys are just kind of, you know, smirking and giving some kind of stupid answer. Like I said, I wish I could have read everything that was on the shirt, but I could see nigger. That was obvious. I just couldn't see what the rest of it said. I think it is on my page. The video's on my page. You can watch it. But as the black guy's leaving them, he's just like, man, I think they just came to try to, you know, spark up some riot, see if they could get something, and then have it on the news that, oh, my God, there was a riot and the black people beat up these white guys for no reason. They were just out minding their business and the niggers chimped out. I think that's the sort of thing that they've been promoting all, even back to last year. I feel like that's what they've been promoting, Alex Jones and all of them. So I would just caution folks about getting too caught up in it all. I mean, definitely you can use it as a moment to talk about racism and hopefully reach out to some other people who normally would not be on this subject matter, but just be cautious. Be cautious about, you know, getting defeatist, feeling depressed, feeling helpless, any of that. Just be really cautious about that. And be cautious that you do not forget there are billions of other victims of racism on the planet who are also suffering under this system. Anybody have any last sentences they wanted to get in before we wrap things up?
Yeah. Go ahead.
I did see that clip with the protest. I noticed that one of the guys had a missile on the back of his T-shirt, too, Francis Cress Wilson moment. And, in regards to the Trayvon Martin thing, it definitely was overwhelming just by turning on the TV and you just being bombarded with the aftermath of the case all week long. And it just made me think, like, who's to say that the actual juror B37 that they said was on Anderson Cooper? Who's to say that that was one of the actual jurors? Who's to say that wasn't just an actor or actress?
I think the racist media, they use stuff like this, I think, 3 to 4 times a year as a psych op mm-hmm. program. To keep people depressed and to keep black people depressed and not feeling good about themselves, because just like you guys were saying before, the last week or so since the verdict, I've heard so many people, especially young people, saying like, this verdict makes me feel like I'm nothing. I'm like, this is what they want people to feel. They want you to feel depressed and useless and worthless. And this is why they pushed this case, because people get killed every day in the United States, but the media picks and chooses which, okay, this is the case. We're going to play this every day. And it gets in your mind. And, you know, if you're not careful, you're walking around, I don't feel good today. I feel depressed. And this is what they want.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, but you definitely have to keep in mind, like, who you're dealing with and how crafty these white people are. Very deceptive. So, like I said, who's to say that Juror B-37 was actually Juror B-37. It wasn't somebody that just CNN created just to ask questions and, you know, just to create a situation, just to have people feeling defeated, like you said. Yeah. Yeah, just keep in mind a lot of us are super confused. I mean, I'm still learning. I'm definitely somewhat not that confused, but just trying to understand who you're dealing with, because these guys are just very deceptive. So definitely got to critically analyze what they do and how they do things, especially with the propaganda, because it seems like they say all these things that we're this and we're that, we're not, that we're all messed up in the head, as far as, when I say we, as far as non-white people, but yet they have to do all these things to try to deceive us, and there's a reason for that. I mean, they're definitely afraid of that genetic annihilation, or white genetic survival, as they say. So, yeah.
We will be back tomorrow evening. Although last week the verdict was out and everything, definitely tomorrow we are not spending the whole program talking about Trayvon Martin. That was what I was supposed to be doing last week. We're going to make sure we devote a chunk of every compensatory call-in to talking about racism on the job or observations on the job, because I feel like white people are just, they have been just terrorizing us there, and that's something that we really should be talking about on a regular basis, sharing observations. If you have been having success, if you're not having problems, if you figured out some things that are making things work out well for you, that definitely should be shared with other non-white people. But that aside, there were a lot of, in fact, I can end right here. The whole time, part of the narrative of all of this around Mr. Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin has been Trayvon Martin, he was a thug and he was on drugs and he was potential looter, robber, thief, whatever the case may be, hoodlum, gangster, wannabe guy. I've been hearing that a bunch too. Wannabe gangster. He was a gangster, wannabe gangster. Right now, the trial that people are not talking about, Whitey Bulger in Boston, you actually have a white man named Whitey who is on trial for all sorts of criminal gang organized activity. They don't have cameras in the courtroom. People have really missed this completely. And I mean, it is the most crazy thing you could imagine. This is like Godfather in real life, where people that were scheduled to testify have ended up dead. People have been cursing and going at it in the courtroom. I mean, it is incredible. And nobody has said a peep about this. I mean, you have an undeniable gangster, not wannabe gangster, not 17-year-old out to get Skittles, but an actual criminal mastermind who had white people in Boston terrorized for years. And this doesn't get any coverage at all. Hardly any. Drowned out in all the Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman talk. And I'm saying this is important because, and I was even reminded, Dick Gregory, he talked about the film American Gangster with Denzel Washington. And he says that's the image that gets projected around the world. The image of the American gangster is a black male. Mm. When white people are the terrorist organization worldwide, have been. I mean, if you want a model, a template for what a gangster is, racist man, racist woman, racist child. And you got Whitey right now on trial in Bulger, in Boston. And I think you have tons of people who have no, like I said, someone who was supposed to testify, a witness, just ended up dead under suspicious circumstances. They don't even know the cause of death. The most recent report that I saw, the witness that just ended up dead, even though they scratched him, he was no longer going to testify. But originally, he was scheduled to testify. And he ended up dead, no cause of death. And this isn't talked about at all. No representation of an actual white gangster killer. organized crime drug lord boss in Boston. No representation of that. We don't want that picture out around the world. We want you thinking gangster Trayvon Martin, the young black males who are suspected in the killing in Georgia, where they are alleged to have shot a 13-month-old white baby down in Georgia. This happened in March of this year. That's the image that we want around the world of a gangster, not white people. Real important. I would just say that to emphasize. Don't get caught up completely in Trayvon Martin. There are a lot of things happening on the planet. There are billions of victims of racism, white supremacy. White people are very good at getting your attention shifted so that you focus here and you ignore other things that are happening on the planet that are also related to racism, white supremacy. Just make sure that you don't get caught up. Lots of things happening. System of racism, white supremacy is war all day, every day. Got to be a soldier. We will be back in about 24 hours for the compensatory call-in. Definitely dial in if you workplace issues. Definitely want to make sure that we have some time devoted to that. The book club, next week we'll be doing a new book. As I said earlier this week, the two leading books right now, Brave New World, Warmth of Other Suns, Vote. If you don't like those are just the leaders right now, you can vote for other books. I think Demery, he had suggested Trojan Horse, Death of a Dark Nation, Pam's book. Pam and I were trying to do a book for this one, a fiction book. She was going to participate, but she said Fridays are very difficult for her plantation schedule. So it's difficult, if not very unlikely, that she would be able to join in for any Friday session. But yeah, folks out have suggestions, thoughts for the book club, get them in. As I said, leaders right now, Warmth of Other Sun, written by a black female, Brave New World, written by a white male. Those are the leaders. If you don't like those, just vote for one of the others. Tell people to vote for your book, and I'll let people know by Wednesday what the outcome is. If it ends up being still knotted with those two being the main vote getters, I'll just put those two up, and then everybody can vote on what they would like between those two if that's how it works out. But we'll see how it goes between now and then. Thanks for tuning in. I hope the book session was constructive. Definitely don't want to be wasting time on the plantation. The blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. Replace white supremacy with justice as soon as possible. For the creator, please give us patience. I think one of the unfortunate patterns I have observed when victims of racism, white supremacy become frustrated, unfortunately, we often take out our frustrations on other victims of racism. Ask the creator to help us maintain patience. Help us to not become frustrated. And when we do, help us to manage that frustration in the most constructive manner possible. Help us make sure we are taking time to replenish ourselves, our souls. Make sure that we take time to manage our lack of mental health. Make sure that we take space and do not release our anger and toxicity on other victims of racism. Other victims of racism are not to blame for our problems. White people, the system of racism is our problem. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Context of white supremacy, signing out.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.